Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, accountants. Wherever you're listening and watching, from wherever you're tuning in, we want to welcome you to this very special episode of the FinTech Flow. This is my new special introduction that I'm doing, just because, not because it's our 25th episode, and not just because we have Stefan here today, back in the house, but because this is our post-busy season mental health special show in honor of Mental Health Month. But yes, it's also our first three-person episode. So it's going to, I think it's kind of cool to see what type of dynamic we're going to deal with having three voices in the room.
I'm repressing all of my thoughts right now.
So we'll see how this goes. Drew and I have a good thing going on. Stefan, let's see how you roll today, man.
Let's see if we can tango.
Mm-hmm.
When you're talking about repressing, are you, is that your strategy for how do you deal with stress, or do you have other insights?
Yeah, I think you just bury it and you bury it and you keep putting more things on top of it until it essentially you no longer feel. I think that's the only way through busy season.
It's certainly one approach.
Well, we're going to have a lot of personalities going on here today on this episode, so we're looking excited to it. Let's just dive right on into it. This is the FinTech Flow. All right, so start things off for those who are perhaps new to the show. This is our 25th episode. I am your co-host, Drew Carrick, producer here at Flowcast Studios, active CPA.
I am Mike Whitmire, co-founder, CEO of Flowcast, currently an active CPA after being inactive for a while. I'll get back to inactive status here in, I think, 9 more months. I'm good to go, but yeah.
Just teasing it. Just wanted to see how it felt again.
Just teasing it. Yeah. After getting suspended.
My name is Stefan Van Dijvendijk. I'm the accounting operational evangelist here at Flowcast. Just a fancy title for a subject matter expert on accounting. We all have accounting backgrounds on this team, and we're just here to kind of commiserate, I think, a lot today.
I think that's the first time I've ever heard you fully introduce your last name.
It's long. I get tired about halfway through. I'm also a little
between
bit...
the last name and the title.
I'm also like have a little bit of imposter syndrome. Like, am I saying my own name correctly? Is there someone out there that says it differently? I don't know.
Well, you know what they do say? Accounts do like having more letters after their name and more letters and more initials. And so let's just keep stringing it out as long as you possibly can.
Exactly.
Stefan's got it in spades.
So we're going to start off with things here on our up-to-date section, or as I like to call it, the in-case-you-haven't-heard rundown. Sam Bankman-Fried got 25 years, deemed worse than Elizabeth Holmes, but not as bad as Madoff. Just our hot takes from 25 years. I think that the over-under was around 30, so this kind of came in, I would say, pretty close to what we would expect.
Yeah, we set a good number there.
Yeah, I think he probably feels pretty good about it. I mean, he's still young enough that he'll have some life to live after he gets out from all of this, which is crazy to think about after all the money that disappeared from this. I mean,
yeah,
he'll be what, 50, 55 or something?
I think 55 in that range.
Comes out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. You know? And then he's going to go on speaking tours and write a book about it and make more money around how I've converted to a good person after
maybe that was his
my
whole
lesson.
His oh, whole thing, gosh. You know?
Yeah.
Jordan Belfort style.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
He wants to get that white collar prison body, you know, where you leave with more weight.
Do they play pickleball at prison?
They do now. Yeah.
Pretty sure.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure.
Probably.
Random story. I stumbled across this YouTube video, which was a guy who is a consultant for people who are going to white collar prison. And so it's this video of him doing some introductory advice on how to optimize your time in a white collar prison. And it's like the most rich person thing I've ever heard. It goes, you know, this will be the most free time you've ever had. So it's a really good time to think about learning something. So what's a new subject you could pick up so that you're more impactful to the world after you leave prison, after all this stuff? And for physical fitness, you know, they have great options generally at these places, all these facilities and all this kind of stuff. It's like a whole different experience than the prisons you drive out to on the way to Arizona, where I drove by San Quentin.
Yeah.
a little bit of a different vibe out there.
Wow.
But yeah, I'm sure he'll have a great time. Also, aren't his parents like really rich and they're going to try to get this thing
probably
overturned and he's going to get out of prison at some point and people are going to be
good,
mad
good
for
behavior
a day,
after 3 years.
Fun.
Yeah. 36 months of not hard time.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. I think the comparison is really interesting. Worse than Elizabeth Holmes, but not as bad as Madoff. I feel like
Madoff got like he got 160 years
on a dollar basis. Isn't FTX significantly larger than what Madoff was doing?
I think it has to do with the extent right? Because here's the thing. I think Elizabeth Holmes is kind of, I mean, it's a little bit messed up because she's talking about like healthcare and medical stuff. Like there's some implications
literal
to
literal life and death stuff.
Mm-hmm. You know, this is obviously a lot of people's life savings and people dumping stuff in here. But Madoff's, his thing went for years.
And it was a lot of people's retirement funds, right? Yeah. So a lot of people like woke up the next morning and there was like a lot of tragedies from that, like personal tragedies from decisions made. So I think kind of given the context, I mean, hopefully people that are investing heavily in Bitcoin had a little bit more eyes wide open than, you know, investing in like a Madoff fund, but hard to say.
Yeah. Also very different clientele.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Madoff's clientele had much deeper pockets to go after him and make that happen, a worse sentence. So maybe something there.
Well, we'll see. We'll see when he actually does end up getting out, but I'm sure everybody will have his eyes on that book deal that I'm sure in the movie that will be made and all of that sort of stuff. So
I am excited for the movies to start coming out around this. They're going to be great.
Yep.
Also, Disney and Iger survived the hostile takeover. I'm kind of in this hostile takeover vibe since I watched Succession. and I just think it's interesting. It's like, you know, are there any ripple repercussions of this sort of thing? Like now that this attempt has been made, obviously the coup failed, but it just shows you there's a sort of internal strife that goes on there whenever.
I totally miss this. Who tried to take over Disney?
There was a major stockholder. I'm Peck, I think is the last name. I'm
something like that.
Pete's Peck. Something with a P. I should have pulled that up here. But he basically tried to rally all the major, you know, any stockholders that he could, shareholders that he could get involved to be like, I don't like the direction that Disney's going. I think Iger is taking us in too, he's being too political about stuff. They're getting too far away from just making good quality content like Disney was bred on and wanted to change the direction of it. And so he tried a hostile takeover sort of situation. It didn't work, but it was still
Do you know
pretty
how many,
impactful.
What percentage of votes they got?
I do not.
I got something up. So it's Nelson Peltz, the co-founder of Trion Fund Management, which is a wealthy hedge fund, reputation of forcing its way into board of directors of various companies to enact its own agendas. Okay. Well, I can tell you from my own portfolio, stocks, Disney stock price is definitely down, so a good time to try to deploy a hostile takeover.
Yeah.
Man, it's so interesting because, you know, on the one hand, yeah, they've kind of strayed from like the traditional Disney stuff of the 90s and 2000s, but also like Bob Iger, from a pure business perspective, has done a great job with M&A, like building out this huge IP library with Marvel and all that kind of stuff, like Star Wars, like I get that it's a distraction from that, but also like he's a business guy building a big business, doing a great, in some ways doing a great job. Like, I don't know, I get some of the frustrations around the topics they've been delving into and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, that's like a small drop in this huge corporate bucket that they have. So,
well, I think these, like, I don't want to like call these people like activist investors, but they act in the same way that they try to like do a takeover of the board, right? All they're looking for is some angle of like discontent that they can kind of like sow or leverage to try and get more seats on the board or to have more control over a company that outsizes what maybe their share purchasing power does, right? So it's interesting. I think what it shows is internally at Disney, there is enough discontent and uncertainty of where the company is heading that they were able to wedge themselves in, but there's not so much that they could make it impactful. But if Iger and the broader board doesn't really shore up those walls soon, that crack in the foundation can really spread, right? So I think it just goes to show that like even a massive company like Disney that has what Iger's really built is a very fertile field, right? With the acquisitions and everything of content that they can leverage and everybody's doing. Everybody's like rerunning stuff from the 80s and 90s that's like halfway into the film, you're like, I think I've seen this before. Right? And then it dawns on you, you're like, I did see this when I was 8. It's just new. But you know, it's a fertile field of content for them that's probably a lot cheaper to go to market with the content, proven record. But it just goes to show, even with that, that there can be easily sown discontent if you're not really aligned as a company on direction, right? So it's kind of wild to just see that like you can be that susceptible to everything. But I feel like, you know, Iger's also done, it's wild because I can't remember his predecessor's name that he just replaced, but
the Game of Thrones that he won.
Yeah,
I'm blanking on his name also. Yeah,
but a very, very common like household name, like you know, but like that kind of started like Chepik or something like that.
Yep. Bob Chepik.
Yeah, and like that started the fight, I believe, with like DeSantis in Florida and everything like that. So they have some big things going on at Disney right now that you're like, interesting to see what will play out here. Will corporate America win? Will like political motivations win? Where is this going to like land in the battlefield? And I think for other CEOs, that's going to be in boards. That'll be a really clear indication on, you know, where their status is in the pecking order of like society right now. Because I think that's in the mix. That's in the air with everybody right now.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I think the social aspect is like an easy one to latch onto and then kind of extrapolate that into the business. But at the end of the day, all that feels like a drop in the bucket compared to everything that Disney has going
Definitely.
On. Like, you know, they still make an ungodly amount of money off the parks. They got their cruise lines mm-hmm. and it is still, I don't know. I see my wife and daughter. It's one of the most powerful brands in the world.
Yep.
It is something else. And they still have that. So it seems like they're heading the right direction. Something to note, like one of my audit clients who is publicly traded, Carl Icahn came onto their board and tried to do a takeover. And mm-hmm. it ends up being a massive distraction for the management
yep.
team. And all of a sudden, they're spending most of their brain power trying to figure out how to deal with this hostile takeover and this activist investor rather than actually running the business and doing mm-hmm. like what's right. So it's, yeah, from like inside the walls, it's probably even more unhealthy than it seems like from the outside, because just like all their time is being spent on the wrong stuff right now.
Yep. And I think when you look at like the talent shortage or like the vacuum of accounting talent out there, it's like, you know, if you're a talented accountant, it doesn't take much to push you over the edge to necessarily leave your company, right? And if I'm sitting there, I'm the controller, I'm the VP of accounting, whatever my role is, I'm an accounting manager, but there may be a key member on your accounting team, and all of a sudden they feel like you're not going in the right direction, their job security might be in question because they don't know what the company's going to do. Really easy to lose that talent. And then to your point, Mike, you just really sidetracked operational efficiencies of the organization. And that can happen in every department. That's not limited to accounting. Obviously accounting has a huge vacuum out there, but like it's like that. I think that's the issue with it is it's like parents squabbling at the top makes everybody underneath feel very uncertain about what's going on that day.
Yeah. Well said. And even from our perspective, it slowed down our audit because all of a sudden if you need the time of the CFO or the CAO, they have other stuff going on that's distracting them. It's not their normal course of business, but all of a sudden this quarter, crap, I have to deal with this and I need mm-hmm. to get this report to prove that why we're making this decision is the right decision, the ROI, all that kind of stuff. It's not like answering the auditor's questions so we can get the 10Q or 10K out on mm-hmm. time, which is, you know, one of the more important parts of their job. But all of a sudden, if it's an existential threat from an activist investor and your job's on the line, you're going to prioritize things a little bit.
Yep.
A little bit differently.
Yeah. I think with all these different conflicting priorities now and so many different areas that business leaders have to deal with in general across companies, you're worrying about DEI, you're worrying about BOI, you're worrying about Corporate Transparency Act stuff, your ESG score, so many different directions that you're being pulled in. The last thing you need is now to deal with some sort of hostile takeover coming internal factors and civil mm-hmm. war. And I think that's why it's going to be super important for leaders to just make sure they have that synergy and alignment across the company. Now more than ever, I think it used to be easier back in the day. There was just like one objective, get everybody on the same page. Now everybody's got their own personal interests and departments have their own certain KPIs that they're trying to hit. And you have this clashing sometimes of objectives, and Disney's fortunately, I think, equipped to handle this sort of situation, but it does kind of highlight for everybody else, like, hey, this can happen, so make sure you're kind of taking the steps to get there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So other stock that is also down is Tesla not hitting its numbers. And this has kind of been circulating all over the place because Elon Musk always finds himself in the center of everything. Mm-hmm. But should they get booted from the Magnificent Seven? It's been a discussion now of like, you know, Tesla stock's down over 30%, which is just mm-hmm. absolutely insane considering how much they took the market. I know you're a big Tesla fan, Mike, but
I am.
I love the stock right now. Well.
You're hitting on my two losers in my portfolio. Jeez, Disney and Tesla, you got to rub it in. I don't know. I was having this debate last weekend, actually. Funny you should bring it up. Do you think they're just a car company or something bigger than that? I think that's the gist of, do you believe that there's a much bigger opportunity than making cars? And I for one, believe in the bigger opportunity. If you think they're just a car manufacturer, I think the stock price is probably high still.
Sure.
If you believe in the bigger vision, then I would say the price is low.
I think it goes back to leadership, though, right? So, like, Elon's definitely removed himself from being as active in Tesla and what it invest in and what it pursues. But for a time, right, they weren't just leading in cars, they were leading in batteries, they were leading in chargers. You know, you had the Tesla battery wall coming out of homes. They were even talking about like doing their own, and maybe they ultimately did it, but like their own version of like solar panels for roofs and all that kind of stuff. But he got focused on Twitter, X, whatever you want to call it, and took all of his focus off the company, which, you know, who knows if that was good or bad or Tesla. But I think when you have that, back to the Disney point, when you start shifting your focus, it's easy to let something slide. And I think that's what's occurred for Tesla, is the rest of the market has seen Tesla as letting something slide in that time. Somewhere when, you know, Steve Jobs passed away and was no longer in charge of Apple, you know, there's a lot of questions on Tim Cook and is he really the leader to it? You know, I think obviously Tim Cook's like clearly led the market valuation in the right direction, but it can be a powerful leader and a really decisive leader can really drive a company. And when they're not there, there's a vacuum. And I think Tesla's essentially feeling that vacuum.
Yeah, I do really like your point though, Mike, about the overvaluation if you view it as just a car company. Because I think a lot of the hedge, and that's with a lot of the stock that exists nowadays with tech companies, is very speculative, where it's just on what's the potential of what this technology mm-hmm. could potentially be. And the odds are, like, most of them probably aren't going to pan out to be very much, or they're mm-hmm. going to get acquired and it's going to just disappear. And you know, whoever made it was great, they got their buyout. But that's a really, I think, interesting angles. Do you think Tesla expands where, you know, the Tesla homes, as I think that was something that was discussed to your point with the having the solar panels on the roof and the batteries, and you're having these autonomous homes essentially. Yep. And if that's somewhere in the framework and it's just kind of like incognito and it's like, yeah, we've got a car here, a car there, that just kind of sustains us, but boom, we're going to come with this big thing and that could shoot it back up again. So it'll be really interesting.
I don't know how much the bigger vision is understood here, but there's the yeah, if they're a car company, then whatever. There's the floor of their stock price is them being arguably the best car company in the world. I still think the vehicles they make are better than any other EV vehicles out there. And if that's the future, then they are going to be the number one car brand car company out there. Elon doesn't need to be there to innovate on mm-hmm. the Model 2 or any of them. Like, the car's great. People aren't going to beat them. We've had other car CEOs admit that they can't compete with Tesla on electric vehicles because of how much Tesla's invested in the ability to build all these on their own and organically. The upside and the wild vision that Elon's put out there, and I think the wheels are already in motion to where this is going to happen organically because of the people he's hired, but this is the big one, is the opportunity to just replace the grid, which mm-hmm. is like an absurd thing, but but the easiest way to have renewable energy in the United States is for solar panels to be on everyone's homes, mm-hmm. connected to batteries. Those batteries can be in the form of either battery walls that Tesla has built, or your car mm-hmm. is a battery as
moving
well,
battery.
Plugged into the grid. So if you have a solar panel on your home, you're connected with the rest of the grid and you're storing energy through your Tesla wall or through your car. You absorb that during the day, you deploy it into your home at night, you can share it across other company or other households as well through the formal grid itself. But it's like some shockingly few number of homes need to have solar panels on top of them to power the entire country. So mm-hmm. to me, it's not about having like out in the desert a massive farm sure. of solar panels. It's having it within your city and then distributed and shared amongst everybody. And that requires the battery technology, the solar panels, and they have both of those things in spades. And then the cars are connected to all that, and that's one big battery pack. And I don't think people think of the car as the battery pack.
Yeah.
So as long as you're plugged in overnight, then you can access all this and share it. And so I'm of the opinion there's still the potential to replace the grid effectively, which is a pretty big prize if you can make that happen. So that's why I think, you know, pretty high floor on the price, pretty high ceiling mm-hmm. on where it could go if they execute on all that. And from an innovation perspective, that's where Elon comes in. And I think we're just in a lull with yep. their company, where it's like the Model 3 came out, the Cybertruck came out, and now they're developing the 2, which is like the $25,000 mm-hmm. car. So that's in motion right now. So it feels like they're not doing anything because a new commercially viable vehicle hasn't hit the market. But I'm seeing them work on the 2. I don't know if you've seen all the robotics they're coming out with, but like they're also investing in these humanoid robots that are going to be doing stuff, which is insane to see these videos, really concerning. They have the new semi-truck that just came out. I saw some self-driving vehicles around the semi-truck that's coming out to replace some of that. So I think it's like a perceived lack of innovation, which is Elon's fault. Then you pair that with missing numbers, and then the street freaks out, and that's what drives the stock price down. So if you're a believer in the long run, you're a buyer right now. If you think it's a car company, maybe you hold or start to sell a little bit.
Yeah. I think my issue with it is I think there's – I do see potential in, like, the grid, right? But I'm renting a Tesla right now to drive around L.A. And, Mike, I'm going to have you come out and help me charge that damn thing.
Why?
I've gone to like three different charging ports and it literally, the connectors don't work. Like I have to go to like a Tesla specific one in the city because I guess there's like enough old ones out there.
Oh yeah, yeah.
No, that don't actually like charge it.
No, go to the Tesla ones.
Yeah. Well, they're all used.
What do you mean?
They're all busy. Like someone's already parked in them. So, you know.
Sherman Oaks Galleria.
That's what I heard.
Right down here. It's got like 30 spots. It's always available.
That's
and
what
if
I'm
you
doing.
If you pop by Starbucks, you can get validated for cheaper than the price of parking. So just charge your car, go in, get yourself a Starbucks. By the time you're done, your car will be charged. You can leave, use your validated
Perfect.
Parking, and you're good to
Very
go.
Nice.
That
to me is Tesla's like major advantage right now is the charging capabilities that they have. Like mm-hmm. no one else has the network that they have, and it's really not. It takes a bit of a behavior change. You mm-hmm. got to get used to like, you don't just pump gas for 2 minutes and you're done. You go get a coffee and then you're charged mm-hmm. afterwards. But like, dude, it's not you. I believe in you, Stefan. I think you can get your car charged.
I appreciate
in LA.
That. Yeah. Yeah. I was definitely having some anxiety the other day when because you don't get the app on your phone, right? So I can't just do fob, walk away, and my car close.
Oh, this
box.
Is because you're renting one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
okay.
I spent
okay.
an hour in the parking lot trying to be like, wait, how do I actually leave this car? Like, what do I do? Which isn't really a Tesla
it's always
problem.
The
That's an adoption
curve.
Issue.
It's like when Max came out and you're like, how do I click X to get out of this thing? That's
yeah,
why
yeah.
I go back to the Lenovo. But you know.
Yeah.
But to wrap things up with the up-to-date section is just Americans believe the economy is worse than it actually is. And it's coined the vibe economy because the vibes rather than the stats actually dictate the perception. I think there is some validity to that. But there is this overall notion of like people just – they just feel, I just don't feel like the economy is doing that well. And the numbers report can come out and say, oh, jobs are up, the stock market is up. Yet people are still like, I really don't feel like the economy is doing well. And it's this notion of the vibes economy, which is, I think, a very Gen Z-ish sort of concept here. But there is some validity to it. It's in the air.
Yeah, I think it's another term for speculative.
Yep.
Right. Like the market was already speculative. And that's what like people were coming in and saying, well, yeah, I believe in this bigger vision of Tesla. Regardless of what the numbers say or the leaders say, or they don't, right? And then the stock fluctuates significantly, even though behind the scenes it might be a completely different story. And so to me, I think it's always been a vibe economy. It's just mm-hmm. a new term for like speculation in our marketplace. And I think with everybody having so much more access to people's interpretation of the numbers, interpretation of the market, I think the average American probably feels more of what's going on in the market than they did 20 years ago, 30 years ago, even 5 years ago. And so maybe like the vibrations or like the ripple effects are spreading out more. But I don't think anything's changed as far as like that's, I don't think that's affecting the market any more than like already analysts are doing that, you know?
Sure.
We got to define the market. What do you mean by that? Is it like the job market or the stock market starters?
True, or just like the U.S. economy.
Well, they're talking about
there are two. The reality is, within our country, there are two economies.
Sure.
There are those who participate in the stock market and those who do not participate in the stock market. And I think the vibe part of it is those who are not participating in the stock market, and the numbers are the people who are participating in the stock market and are feeling good about stuff. I get to, I'm more of a believer in the vibe and not the numbers that are being put out because
now I know what your style in Vegas is.
Because everyone, yeah.
You're feeling the vibe at the table.
You don't win on logic. You don't win on logic in Vegas. Yeah, but I feel like if you're the White House, you're going to put out whatever reports make you look and feel mm-hmm. good. And the CPI calculation does change mm-hmm. time and time again. Mm-hmm. You're able to remove certain things and add certain things into that bucket, the basket that drives inflation. I mean, at the end of the day. Sure, unemployment might be low, but if people aren't making enough to compensate for the inflation, that's clearly there. The less money you make, the more hit you are by inflation.
Yep,
the more you make, the less. So someone who has enough money to have a sizable amount in the stock market, they're watching that go up. They couldn't care less that milk goes from, you know, doubles in price or whatever. It does not impact them at all. Mm-hmm. Versus if you're one of the people making, you know, minimum wage, all the cost of all that stuff matters to you. And you're talking about much lower dollars overall than what the full market looks at. But at the same time, they're one human being. The rich person's one human being. They have an equal say in the vibe of the economy. And I would say that like the majority of the people in America, probably aren't feeling good about
it. Yeah, I would say it's that sort of
pervasive. I think you can mask it with numbers, I guess, is the like mask it with numbers that aren't applicable to those people.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think there's also, and I've spoke about this on the podcast before, there's this sort of pervasive energy amongst the younger generation of just lack of optimism for what the future is. So there's that vibe of just like negativity, I think, and pessimism that just exists over like the overall outlook, regardless of how the economy is during at the current moment. And then there's also the reverse impact of that, where the economy actually does better because people care less, in the sense that they're like, well, screw it, what's the point? Might as well spend it. And there's a lot of that, I think, which has been going on in the economy as of late, where it's like, well, it's going to take my job. I'm never going to be able to keep up with inflation. Why even bother trying to save for a house if I'm never going to be able to afford it anyway? So mm-hmm. let me just go have some experiences. And that's why, at least temporarily, I think you see a boom in a lot of money from these companies showing profit, because people are spending their money because they're kind of have this lack of hope of why save it.
That's an interesting point. When you feel like you're never going to be able to buy a home, why save? Sure. Why save any money at that point? You might as well lean into it.
It'd be interesting to see, like, you know, because they do track how much savings is in like per American household, right? Yeah. And they average that out. It would be interesting if they segmented that by like age group and say like, like, you know, generation, you know, Gen Z or, you know, like young millennials are saving significantly less than Gen X versus boomers versus whatever.
Yeah.
And like what's merely impacting that decision making.
I guarantee you, the older that is, the older you are, the bigger your savings account is getting, in general.
No, I'm saying, but generation over generation. So you know, when they were in their 20s, they probably had, you know, even if it was $1,000, they were probably saving $1,000 a month.
You want a cohort analysis around different generations? Yeah, that's really funny you should say that. Had a kind of back in the home buying thing. My uncle sent our family a group text message, which was like an old-timey news article he came across, where it was like the 1954 housing market in LA. And it was like, buy a home for $27,000. And they were all like reminiscing around when it was so cheap to buy a home. And they were completely missing out on the fact that it was a bunch of boomers sending this to like Gen X and millennial and even Gen Z.
All their children and grandchildren
were like, I can't afford that anymore. So when you... I remember I did like an inflation adjusted calculation on it, and it was like, okay, today that home would cost $200,000.
Mm-hmm.
In LA, your average home is what, over $1 million
yeah.
at this point?
Yeah.
So, hey, mom, if that house was six times as much back then, would you have been able to afford that home, particularly with like a lower minimum wage and all this kind of stuff? So it really like juxtaposes how little it costs back then to get into a home
yes.
versus how ridiculous it is today. And there's just a complete lack of awareness around that from that generation. It's a really fascinating dynamic that we kind of have going on. This like inability to accept that things are just harder for younger people now financially.
It is
what it is. Yeah.
I think the other issue is like people don't like, they almost want it to be harder for younger people to like toughen them up. And which it's like, you know, sometimes I fall into that category where I'm like, well, they're just being a wuss. Like, you know, harden up a little bit. You got to be able to live your life. But at the same time, it's like inherently we should want it easier for the people that come after us. Like I don't suffer in a job so that my, whoever takes my successor that takes over it has a worse time, right? Like that defeats the purpose of why you do anything, why even try hard in the first place. And I think there's a lack, like there's a generational lack of like, well, wouldn't you want it better for people, not harder? And that, I think that's completely lost in society right now. Like in multiple generations, not just like an older generation, but even like, you know, like Gen X and millennials, I think look at that way at Gen Z. And it's like, hey, let's take a step back and say like, our overall goal is to make it better for the next generation, not worse, not harder.
Yeah.
This is interesting pontification. I think people apply that to their own kids,
mm-hmm.
but not like society at large.
Right.
I'm going to leave it at that.
Very true. And it's a perfect segue into one of these things that exists, which is burnout. And I think a lot of that comes with this notion of people who have been, especially in public, I found, where you pass down the misery to the next mm-hmm. grouping. It's like, well, it was tough for me to get here. It's going to be tough for you to get here. And that's just the way it is, because this is how we format our worksheets. This is how our work papers are done. And if you don't have it in Times New Roman, or Arial size 12, mm-hmm. 80% zoomed in on your Excel document, then don't send it back to me, or I'm going to give you a note and send it right back.
Yeah, we'll put you on performance review, because you don't know how to format.
Can I just say that one of the top things that plays into preventing burnout and thinking about the people that are coming after you here is refusing to eat hours on your audit engagement. This was something where, you know, when it was asked of me to basically, it suggested I should eat some hours, it was literally like, well, if I do that today, I'm setting up the next team for failure next year, because that's going to be the expectation on how long it takes them to do this account. So no, I'm not doing this in the spirit of whoever's coming after me. I don't care about eating hours and my job's less profitable. I don't give a crap, because I want that next staff too to not be beholden to these like irrational goals that were set out by being forced to eat hours. Good.
Is that how you didn't get any weight in public accounting? Because I just ate my hours. Just shoving them down. Put them in shakes, put them in cereal. I ate all of them.
When I get
stacked on some weight.
Fortunately, when I get stressed out, I stop eating. that's how it works for me.
I mean, you feeling all right then, Mike? You're looking kind of
no, the skinnier right I am, the more unhealthy I am, man. It's not like it's a reverse correlation.
That's going to be like, that's going to be my vibe energy when I'm like, I don't care what Mike says about the numbers this quarter. Is he looking a little
how's
gaunt, or is he looking well fed?
How sunk in are his cheeks and eyes? that's how
can
we're doing.
Zoom in on that. Can someone zoom in on that? I want to see how Mike's looking.
Yeah. Could Mike's weigh in at the gym be considered insider trading? It's like, so an insider reported they saw him at the scale the other day. but this is, I mean, there is this two dynamics. There's the people who go, you know, they don't eat because they're just busy working, and then there's the other side where it's just, that's the only treat that you get to have.
Stress eating.
I came from a situation I remember in public where we'll get into some of these public accounting sort of horror stories or burnout stories. And one of them was, they's like, I'm going to really try to eat healthy. And he's like, 3 days into it, he's like, I realized that the only part of the day I look forward to is lunch.
100%.
And so I'm not going to go have like a salad that doesn't taste very good. And it becomes a culture within, you're not able to work out. And the only thing that gives you joy is getting to eat something tasty.
Well, and I think the other thing too is like, you know, back when I was in public accounting, and I don't know if it's the same today, but you're not paid very well. I mean, like, I walked out of public accounting, I got an 80% pay increase. That's wildly inappropriately, right? Yep. You know, like, you should not be able to get that kind of pay increase walking out of your job. And it's not like I walked out for the best price I could have into industry. But I think one of the other things, like, to me, it was part of like, I'm going to get every dime out of you I can get, you know, so I'm going to eat this. Or even if I don't, like, I'll be wasteful and I'll throw it away. But like, I am spending your money in some capacity because you don't want to spend money. I think it's changed a little bit. I think they had a hard time recruiting people during the pandemic, and so they've paid a little more, but they're probably still well underpaid compared to what they could get in industry. Mm-hmm. So I think that's another thing for them to kind of take into consideration with it.
And relative to what you're being paid, all of a sudden the like meal reimbursement dollars are meaningful. It's like, oh, if it's $20 a night for dinner times five, you know, okay, wait, there are 250 days, all of a sudden that's another... what I get to, $5,000 per year that I'm effectively making. That's like back when I started, I was making $48,000 my first year as a staff accountant. Yeah. So that's a 10% raise. Like
49, Mike. I was one grand away from you.
Oh, you beat me. Boom. All right.
Well, I was at 59 when the time I started, which was probably 4 or 5 years
Look
after.
At you, Drew. No, I was a flat $4,000 a month. Let's go.
Well, here's the thing is what I think is happening within this is the starting salary actually has been going up. It, like, I was even shocked to be like, now what they're making. And I'm like, geez, like, it took me years to get to that point. Mm-hmm. But I think the problem is that, yeah, it took me years to get to that point. They're starting people at this higher thing. But as soon as they get in, they kind of get stagnated right away, which is kind of a reverse psychology. I feel like you need to reward the people who are going to stick it out and stay there and give them even more, because it's so hard to train and it's so expensive to train new people when it comes to getting them into accounting.
I agree with that. I remember when I was an instructor at KPMG and we were doing the national level like instructor training. They get us all together and they kind of do their like internal report of what they think, you know, academics does for the accountant versus what they need to do. And they're like, we essentially think that like colleges are almost like 10 years behind in what they're teaching like nationwide. And we need to fill that gap plus some, right? Because not only do we need to bring them up to speed, but then we need to have them specialize, whether it's audit or tax advisory, whatever it is. And so that's what we were trying to do. And that's what KPMG and all the big four and you know, regional firms, everybody does in their training, is they're essentially just in a very condensed amount of time being like, okay, well, let's actually make you a useful individual to us now, because you did not come out of university useful. And I felt that way. Like, I remember when I first walked on the job, I was like, I don't remember this. And I felt like I had a pretty good educational background where I went. And I had a few professors that were in audit that really tried to explain it. But there was so much lacking foundation that you really walk in there, you're like, oh, so what was I doing for that like last 5 years?
Yeah. I feel like audit, you just kind of have to do it to learn it, in my opinion. It's a really hard thing to learn in a textbook and then step into a job and be effective.
Well, that's why I feel like it's important to reward the people who do stick it out. And I say this because I think there is starting to be this notion of, all right, we need to pay them more to catch them up. But they're just using it as the capture. And it's the old intern trick, right? Which I feel like the internships are kind of like a waste of money. It's like, well, let's try to capture and get as many people in the pipeline as possible.
Yep.
But they very quickly realize that they hate what they're doing, and it's too stressful, and there's all this different personalities you're trying to deal with. And then they leave after a year or two. And so all you did was pay somebody who kind of was checked out after 6 months. And I've spoken to a lot of young people in the profession, and they're like, they reach out to me and they're a year into public accounting. They're like, all right, I'm looking for like to pivot and go on to my next thing, which is totally fine if your personality doesn't jibe with it. But the amount of people who are just so ready to check out right away, you're not really giving your all and your effort in to start off with from the beginning. And that's the thing I've always regretted, is I kind of always knew there was going to be something else next. So it sort of takes away from your ability, I think, to learn as much as you can.
That's interesting. Yep. You're not as focused on like eye on the bigger prize.
I
remember you started a price and then it's sort of marginal percentage increase. And then when you get promoted, that's when there's
the
like
promotions
a decent bump with it. So I feel like today, I don't know, seniors are making like decent money, but also has that kept up with all the cost of living adjustments, like particularly with rent? That's the one. Mm-hmm. Rent's such a meaningful part of your expenses, and that's the one where it seems to have just gone absolutely nuts over the last few years.
Yeah. So anyway, this overall pervasive burnout that is just, it's been a talk of the industry for forever. What it means for the accounting profession, of course, is fewer accounting majors. They see the burnout. They don't want to go into that. Even those who just leave public, they create the stereotype around the accounting profession as a whole of just, I needed to get out. And that, regardless of whether you're talking about public or private, it's pervasive amongst the whole entire industry, just from those people who are the loud, miserable individuals, rightly so. And then results in people leaving the industry just altogether, being like, I don't even want to do anything adjacent to accounting. I just want out.
I mean, we even have a stat on that. And I don't want to jump like the gun on what we're talking about, but we did a survey here at Flowcast with the University of Georgia, and one thing they found out is like, I think it was something like 53% of employees, accounting professionals, and this wasn't just staff or mid-level, it wasn't just senior level, it was including executives, were unsure if they would stay with their current organization over the next 2 to 3 years. Like, they're like high uncertainty of that. And of that 53%, I think it was like something like 65% weren't even sure if they would stay in the profession. So you're talking about a third of the population is essentially saying, I'll bounce from the profession itself. So you already have an accounting vacuum where we have less graduates coming in. We had, I think it was in 2020, 75% of CPAs were retirement age. I can't imagine how bad that figure skewed now, that are going to be forced into retirement if they're not already because of life. And so you have this huge vacuum going on there. And then the population that remains, well, even that, a third of that is uncertain to even stay in the profession. And so I think that speaks volume for what, like how for granted accounting's been taken by executives within the organization, has been taken advantage of by even like, partners in, the audit industry, the tax industry, advisory industry, and all the firms. We've just taken advantage of it for years, and we've assumed that, I think they've looked and they're like, well, I was able to make through it, so why can't they? And I think there's been a line of sight where they're a POV loss where, when audit partners were doing associate work, accounting was much simpler, much simpler. Organizations were much smaller, and you were allowed to do stupid things like circular references. No one even considered like IPE, SOX, circular references, level of precision. None of that was discussed. So you had a significantly lower threshold to cross to get to a reasonable assurance level. And now that their partners or their CFOs or their VPs or CIOs, whatever it is, they've lost sight of how much more sophisticated and complex you have to be at a staff or an associate level. Whether you're in public accounting or whether you're in the industry, doesn't matter. You are a much more sophisticated like asset to the organization than you were 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Stellar point.
So I think that's why you have this large group that's like, man, I've had enough of this. I've been taken advantage of too long. And I also think the other thing I look at is, in general, when I look in organizations, leaders outside of the CFO and even sometimes the CFO genuinely do not understand how to use their accounting org. They do not know what they're good at. They don't know what they're useful for. And so they mistreat them, and they, don't know how to, connect with those individuals, leverage those individuals. So people don't feel like they're a strategic asset in the organization, that they're contributing to anything when they could. And it's just because people are using the tool the wrong way, right? Like, they're using the screwdriver, they're flipping it over and using it as a hammer, you know? And it's like, well, yeah, like that just defeats the purpose of everything you were trying to do. And so what happens is people say, well, I'll just find something that is more meaningful, because people have, you know, it's like, if I'm not going to get paid, you're treating me like crap, then, you know, something has to change, and then they have to force the change. So I think those are a lot of the pressures that are pushing down on the industry in general that are just forcing people out of it. And until we shift the paradigm, which, I mean, Mike, you've mentioned this. One of the reasons I work at Flowcast is this is something that Mike's brought up, and even like Chris, the chief product officer, brought up, is we want to shift that paradigm of how people view accounting and how we do accounting to where it's like, you know, let's get us out of this negative cycle, and like, let's really just change the way we look at it in a new light, because it is possible to be better. We also saw in our stats that there were people that actually do find that they're strategic assets in the organization, that they are valued in their organization. They do have a good relationship with their technology. And it's not a small population. It's anywhere from 20 to 25% of accounting professionals are actually in that bucket. So a good portion are there, but most of us aren't. So how do we shift that and skew it in the right direction?
How do we get them to be the loud ones talking about the profession, not the people who complain about it all the time?
Yeah, because just living their life. They're being happy. They're everything's so good. Tough.
Like, they're not the ones posting on Reddit.
Yeah.
I would love for them to be the ones posting on Reddit. It would make it like mm-hmm. a much more compelling field, but unfortunately it's all the negative Nancys are out there.
Yeah.
Posting about it.
But it's also most of the population.
Yeah.
You know, so it's easy for them to overwhelm that silent minority, because, you know, they're like, well, I'm already good. Everything's good. I don't really feel like I have anything to say. And most of the population is upset. Well, of course, it's going to push people away.
Yeah. It's a vicious cycle.
Yeah. And burnout defined is an extended period of stress that feels as though it cannot be ameliorated. I learned that ameliorate means to make something better.
Oh, nice. Very so, nice.
Word of the day.
You learned that from Colin?
That is the word of the day. So if stress is short-lived or tied to a specific goal, it's most likely not going to be harmful. The problem, of course, with busy season is not just tied to a short goal. It's a perpetual cycle that continues mm-hmm. over and over. And if the stress feels never-ending and comes with feelings of emptiness, apathy, hopelessness, it may be indicative of burnout. And I think that's just something that's proliferated around the entire industry. And it does get passed down and passed around, because those couple happy voices aren't saying anything. And
yeah, I mean, it's hard to even like sit next to a coworker that's like negative all the time, right? Like, even if you're like, you are a fairly positive person, if you're sitting there with someone that's just always negative, you're like, can you just smile? you know, like it can be difficult to be that to be that happy person next to them and get dragged into it. And I'm not saying that person that's upset is wrong. I mean, like, everybody has a different experience and everything like that, and they could be very justified in what they're feeling, but it does just make it really hard to like kind of pull out of it. And it is something that when we perform the study, to your point, Drew, it's like it's not just that you're tired, it's that like you literally have no job satisfaction. It's interrupting your personal life. You know, it's borderlining like symptoms of depression, you know, not to like overblow it, but like it's mirroring a lot of that stuff. So it's not just one aspect of the persona, like it's really impacting that individual on multiple levels of who they are.
Yeah. And what's interesting and kind of disturbing about it is there's almost this idolization of the misery within it. Cause like you said,
for sure,
that happy person doesn't want to sit next to that miserable person, but that miserable person will happily have more miserable people be around them. And then that just sort of perpetuates itself until eventually the happy people leave, right? Because yep. they're like, all right, well, I'm not going to deal with it. So you almost create this isolated scene, this crew of people who are miserable. And I kind of relate it to like being emo. There's just this like self-depressive nature of it.
It wasn't a phase. It was
because yeah. I don't know. I mean, I don't know what your experiences have been, but I know people who I worked with in public accounting, there was a shared bondage over being miserable together and working these things. And you'd complain about it, but you'd also put yourself through it and kind of shun anybody that wasn't being miserable with you.
Again, I don't want to like overstate it, but it's almost like a level of like trauma bonding, right? Yeah. Like I don't want to diminish people that are actually trauma bonding, like it is very similar. And like, I mean, I have a good friend that works in a similar role, and we joke about how like our best friends are from like our same cohort, are from our same like lifestyle at KPMG. You know, or they've lived a very similar one at Grant Thornton or E&Y or PwC or whatever firm it was, because you just have gone through the battle together and you fought it and you faced it together, that like there's just something about that bond and that friendship that's different. And I've fallen into that like path of being like, well, you know, you kind of wear the hours you work on your shoulder, right? You're like, well, you know, like you only did a 60-hour week. Well, I was working 85 last week, you know, or like, oh, you thought you had a hard busy season. Well, I had to do three back-to-back busy seasons because I have I had a 12:31, I had a 3:31, and I had a 6:30, you know? And it's like, you know, there's always this like this one-upping pecking order of that. And it really isn't the way to do it. But I have fallen in that like route of being like in that pecking order, being like, well, I did this. And like you said, it's like, well, maybe we probably shouldn't be celebrating this. You know, we should be highly concerned for the individual, not necessarily being like, hey, good job working that 85s, you know?
I mean, I think I'm going to touch on this a little later, but like, how do you address that? I think technology actually does help, and not to be cliche about it, right? Where it's like a lot of everybody's like, oh, I want to make a technology that's going to help make the job easier. But that was one of my big gripes, was it was this notion of like, let's go ahead and add popcorn machines and let's try to do culture building and bring your whole self to work. Let's make you have this camaraderie with your team. I was like, if you just make the system operate a little bit better, if we could have this audit software not be as clunky, I think that would actually alleviate a lot of stress from my life. And so I think there's a lot of a...
Yeah, if you get slightly better support from your customer, your clients, because, you know, they actually had it centralized in one place or like had evidence, you're like, well, yeah, my life would be a lot easier. You just handed me like a half scanned document and said, here's your PO. And you're like, well, did you draw this? Is that crayon? You know, it's like... How am I supposed to use this?
So right here, I've got a text message. This is an actual text message from this weekend because, you know, but at the time of this recording, of course, we're right here at the busy season finale, both for tax professionals, obviously audit professionals wrapping up, those who had their 331s, there's other 431s coming. This is an actual text message. A lot of my colleagues back in the Northeast, there was an earthquake there last weekend, and... My one friend who works for a big four company in the tax department said, I thought this was the end. I was like, finally, no more deadlines. And it's just, it's sick that that's the type of humor that just exists. I mean, this is constantly showing up in our group chat.
Yeah. And he wasn't kidding. He was serious. He was dead serious.
4.8 is no joke.
No, it isn't.
For someone, your first earthquake, that's no joke.
I still remember when I felt actually felt my first earthquake, because I live in the Mountain West. I live in Utah, and so we don't get them very often, or at least ones you can feel. And I was sitting working at Skull Candy, like, and we had these tall desks, and so I was sitting on this like high chair that rolled, and it shook so hard I was like, you know, at my desk, and the next thing I know I was like 10 feet back from my desk because it had just rolled me away from it. And I literally looked around, I was like, did I just... Am I tripping? Like, what? What just happened? I was like, that was an earthquake. I was like, okay, cool. Wasn't just me. And like, everybody just shifted away from their desk that they were like sitting at a chair, and we're like, what is going on? We had one guy, like, I think fell off a skateboard or something like that, because they skate around the office and like kind of like shook him off of it. And I mean, if you think about New York, like, you know, LA, at least they build for earthquakes here, right? So you have some assurance in you that like, at least hopefully they've engineered this building to handle some kind of magnitude. To my knowledge, that's not what they do in New Jersey and New York. So I'd be a lot more afraid if I'm in like one of those high rises that already sway in the wind at an earthquake hit. I'd lose my mind.
Yeah, for sure. Like I was at the 17th floor of the EY building in downtown LA during an earthquake. And yeah, the building sways and like moves because it's constructed to do that. So, but man, earthquakes are scary. Like the you realize the power. Of Earth.
Yeah.
and like, man, any minute just the fault shifts a little bit and it could be the end of like, end of a lot of stuff. So
you can't do anything about it.
No, you can't do anything about it. I didn't even know there was a fault in New Jersey here. I'm even looking it up. It's like, all right, it's called the Rampato fault, apparent fault line.
Apparently. Here's the crazy thing is there's just been so much of this type of content that I've received from my friend here he's just grinding it out. I think he's like, you know what, I'm just going to keep going through to partner.
Yeah.
He's got the personality that he can kind of absorb the misery. Yep. And it's funny when we're around him because it's kind of like self-deprecating.
Yeah.
But it is kind of sad at the same time.
Yeah, he's like you're almost getting the laptop. Worried. Yeah.
Every time we need a character for PBC, I'm pulling on real experiences that I've gotten either from myself or from him. And I'm like, I'm using that as a typecast.
Yeah.
All right.
I don't want to give away anything of season 3, but is he the type that would bring his laptop to a wedding?
Yes. Yes. And for those who haven't seen the social media bit on our channel of, you know, when it's the video, I had the idea from it is like, what if you're at a pool party in Vegas, but you've got your laptop out and you're sitting there and the bottle service comes over and hanging out, and you're just like cranking away because we would go to parties and yeah, he's there with the laptop.
Anybody ever think he was the DJ?
<That'd be funny.
laughs> Just put some headphones on him.
Dirty mic. So, so this is some of the stats that you were kind of bringing up earlier. 99% of accountants are suffering from burnout. I mean, that's just a staggering statistic, and it's from that that Georgia survey, and it uses the MBI Maslach Burnout Inventory 100-point scale, and it was focused on emotional exhaustion, depersonalization, and low sense of personal accomplishment. 81% of accountants had their personal lives disrupted at least once a month, once due to the month-end close, and 85% had to reopen their books to fix errors.
Yep. And there's multiple people that have it interrupting their personal life like multiple times a year, right? Which to me is like, if I'm a manager or an employer, like that is, that's not okay. That's inappropriate for me to be interrupting personal life. Like obviously things happen and people need to rally around the issue. But the close, which is an iterative process, you know, you should have like a working cadence on, you should be comfortable with, should not be one of those. It should be really like one-time unique events that would require someone to have that interruption, you know, like a hostile takeover, something of that nature. You know, I'm just spitballing out here. Yeah. But, you know, it shouldn't be something as, you know, not saying that the close is easy. I do not believe that in the slightest, but not something that you should have so much, you know, specialization and working cadence at.
Well, the close is at least predictable.
Yeah.
It's the hostile takeover. Oh, we bought a company. We're getting ready to go public. This new firm's investing in us. All of a sudden, you know, we have to do due diligence. It's those one-off things like that, that pops up. But in the ordinary course of business, people should be able to make their kids' birthday parties and things like that.
And I think that's the problem is you can't be a regular, normal person with a normal life and be an accountant just doing your normal, regular job. Obviously, you'll have the one-off situations. And I kind of refer to when we have to film a PPC, you know it's going to be a month of chaos. But that's a one-off situation that happens every couple of years when you have a big project you're working on. This is like a known thing. Busy season, we know it happens every single year. And beyond that, you know the month-end close is happening every single month. And you know you're having your year-end close at the end of the year. These are very predictable things. We know it happens. And yet we just continue to do it. It's like, you can't live a normal life. No, you're just not going to go to the gym. You're just not going to work out. You're not going to socialize. And you're going to bring your laptop everywhere. And you're going to do your work all the time because that's your job. You're an accountant. And that's where I think there needs to be the change in perspective. Because you can't say it's normal to just not have a normal life. You didn't sign up to join the military where you know you're going to go sent off and do a tour. But there's literally, I always refer to it as tours of busy season. How many tours of busy season have you had?
And survived. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's a crazy stat to think about. And it's what, and again, it's really sad because, like, you know, we talk about, like, it's not just like exhaustion, it's emotional exhaustion, it's depersonalization of who you are. So you start, like, essentially, like, separating yourself from who you are and like and kind of being in a weird void and just like low sense of accomplishment, right? Like this, like I would never want anybody to feel that in any aspect of their life. And yet the way we are approaching our work, to your point, Drew, is driving that and reinforcing that. Again, people are able to get out of this, and it's not an insignificant portion of accountants that have found success. But by and large, a majority of us are in this very bad place, and we need to, like, you know, nothing's going to change if we don't change something, right? If you don't add to the equation, it remains the same. So you gotta play with your different levers there. Business is never going to become less complex. Regulation is never going to become, you know, like less overbearing. The market's never going to become less volatile, right? If anything, like the spikes are just happening like in bigger ways and more often. Those things are constants. So what do you have to do? Well, you have to look at things outside of that, other levers to pull to kind of change the narrative. Mm-hmm. One of those is the way you work and the technology you use. Those are kind of like the only things you can really rely on. And until we take that very seriously, nothing's going to change. And so some people, I think, believe in that and really try to embrace that. We try and embrace it here at Flowcast. But it does take an even a cultural shift within your department as well. And people, to your point earlier, not wearing the hours on their sleeve as a badge of honor, but instead saying, like, this is not appropriate. This isn't what we should be doing. I will not do this to my team, and saying, we're going to change that. So instead of looking at my accounting team and rewarding those that are working super late and saying, why would I ever do that to you? Like, go live your life. And that sometimes, you know, they talk about this. I had our history professor in college that said, like, you know, like, history books change once the older generation passes away because they refuse to let it go. Mm-hmm. And he's like, and then you'll see, like, literally, like, history books update in a big swath, and then that generation passes and it updates again with, like, with better content. It's not like, you know, it's like we're essentially removing, you know, multitudes of just, you know, hey, well, this is what this person wants to believe or whatever, right, biases. And I almost think that we're kind of finding that in accounting, where we really do need some of these people to leave the industry so we can really shift to the right culture here. And that's unfortunate to say, but, like, sometimes I feel like, man, you just get some sticks in the mud that, like, refuse to be moved.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And your point earlier around the job is so much harder today than it was when a lot of CFOs were doing it, is, but that really landed with me. And so I wonder if by the time people who are doing the more complex job today are in those leadership roles, if they'll respect the work that's being done by mm-hmm. the lower ranks a little bit more, and maybe that starts to even out and solve the problem a little bit.
Hopefully. I think you can start to sense it too, even just from managerial styles of individuals. There is a little more sympathy and empathy for new employees coming in. Like, I understand that this is a little bit complex because I was in that position, and I mm-hmm. know what it feels like to sit there and look at a work paper and be like, I don't even know where to begin. You're kind of shaking. You get a little hot, mm-hmm. as if, like, you just started. You have to take a test that you didn't study for.
Yeah.
You studied the wrong chapter, and now you're like,
and this one's a job. This one, yeah. It's not just one grade. It's like, no, this is my job. Yeah,
there's no answer book at the end.
This the comment around, like, low sense of personal accomplishment is really landing with me. I'm wondering if that could be a management thing as well, because I think the jaded argument there is like, oh, cool, I just finished this audit opinion so that rich people can decide whether they want to invest in the company or not. Like, that's like the kind of most jaded angle to take on this whole thing. But conversely, like, yeah, you're there to do a job. You want to make sure that everything's accurate. That's great. You're working as a team. You're trying to hit a deadline. Like, maybe there's a little more positive celebration we can do around it. And I just came back from our President's Club meeting where we celebrate sales and all that kind of stuff. And I'm wondering if that should be applied a little bit more towards accounting as well, because sales, also very stressful job, hustling at the end of the quarter to hit your number. But then sales is very good and maniacally focused about celebrating the wins, yep, and feeling really good about what they've accomplished. Even though at the end of the day, you could just say, oh, congratulations, you sold some software and you got a commission check. Like, that, like, you can say that if you really want to be jaded about it. But no, they worked really hard, had a great quarter, mm-hmm. like, were able to get some great partners and sign some deals and hit their number, and let's celebrate that and congratulate it. And I don't know how much celebrating accounting does around hitting deadlines, getting the books closed,
being, nope, just being an expectation.
Like, the, yeah, so maybe, like, a little more relentless positivity around getting the work done and hitting deadlines would be just a healthy culture to have. I know it's a soft, squishy thing to put out there, but I don't know, something there.
You make an excellent point, though, because, like, I fell into this when I was the controller. Like, you know, sometimes you look at sales and, like, the president circles and stuff like that, and you're like, these a-holes.
Yeah.
Celebrating like this. I was like, I'm killing myself over here. I'm in here every day before you. I'm here later than you every day, working harder than you every day, and yet I don't even get a pat on the back. If I mess up, you know, I got a CEO and a CFO breathing down my neck looking at me like, what are you, some kind of idiot? And it's like, you guys can't do this.
Yeah.
And it's a drastically different, just, you know, tone at the top from the leaders. And then that kind of, I think that breeds culturally into you, where you look at other departments and, like, I felt that way about sales. I'd feel that way about marketing sometimes. Now I work in marketing, which is wild. So yeah. Shoes on the other foot. And it's just, but it's just somebody said, just like, you just like, well, why are you celebrating just doing your job? You just met the expectation, and they're like clapping you on the back. The difference is sales knows that positive momentum and that positivity breeds better results. They know that breeds better results through the numbers. This mm-hmm. isn't, they're not just doing it because they want to and they're like, well, we're set. No, they're doing it because they see that it makes a better, stronger sales team. So to your point, Mike, I never thought about this. How do you change that attitude on your accounting team to be the same way and realize that positivity will change the outcome that your team has towards even the close in their financial reporting?
And people need to understand that comes from sales management. That's not, like, yeah. I as a CEO, I'm not like, and Razak, our CFO, doesn't come to me and be like, we need to carve out X amount of dollars to have a sales club to celebrate all their accomplishments. That comes from sales leadership. They go, hey, we need to have a club. This is a really hard job. People who exceed quota, like, we want them to be excited about that. We want them to, we want to reward them with this big thing. And also it gets everyone else who didn't make club excited about what they're missing out on. Yep. You get a little FOMO going and it gets more people fired up about it. And so that's from management. So you can't like put that on the CEO or the company at large that we're not celebrating accounting. That's like, you got a controller, CFO, they got to look themselves in the mirror and realize maybe they're not being positive enough about the accomplishments that their team is making.
I do think that, but I think that they're going to be met if they're like, hey, I want budget to celebrate my team or do something to, you know, not even to the same degree. They're going to be told no. Because I feel like
Greg finds budget for stuff.
I think that's why it's on all of us.
Greg's our controller, for those who don't know.
I think this ties back into what we're trying to do in elevating the accounting profession as a whole, because it has to be pervasive amongst everybody at the industry to respect and appreciate that which the accountants are doing. Because right now they're just viewed as like a cog in a wheel. And that's where I think the low sense of personal accomplishment comes from. It's a thankless job. It's just like, well, you're just doing the stuff that has to get done because it has to get done. We're out here growing the company, growing the business. It's like, yeah, well, if we all just left, if we accountants just left, what would happen, right? Like a world without accounting, which is one of those ideas that you had, Mike, which if the accountants just stopped showing up or just didn't do their job well, everything else kind of starts to slip away and fall apart. And you kind of bring up a good point, because we talk about like when we wrap on production, and it's kind of funny because we're all coming from the different angles that we've had. After production, you've grinded out, like you have a wrap party because it inspires everybody who worked on the project to like, I can't wait for the next one. Even though you killed yourself for 3 weeks to do it, you're looking forward to the next one because you know there's that sort of sweet, like, yes, we accomplished our goal. We finished the deliverable we were looking to do. And with accounting, it's just, all right, you finish that one, go to the next one. Finish that one, go to the next one. All right, busy season ended. Congrats, go on vacation. And it's like, it's become so routine that I remember when there was like only one time I think I was ever at an audit where when we finished the audit, there was like a wrap party for the audit. It was like, hey, we issued today. Let's go celebrate. Let's go have at least a nice dinner. And that just felt, even though it's so minor, but it went a long way. And those things sort of just started to disappear. Nobody was doing them anymore. And they're like, well, we're kind of busy. We got to go to the next one.
That's a really good point. In audit, it was more like, okay, we've issued the report. Like, you can go take a couple days off. And then you're sort of just by yourself. And you're like, okay, cool. I get to recover a little bit. But there's no camaraderie that comes with the fact that you had just accomplished like a team sport effectively. You worked as a team to get the audit done. And now that you're saying that, I actually remember like the one time in my accounting career where that happened, which was we submitted our first draft of the S-1. At Cornerstone, we had worked really hard to get that first draft to the SEC, and CFO was like, let's go to happy hour, let's have a good time. And you know, we show up, we're at a really nice place by the beach, we have the ocean view. He's like, I'll take one of everything on the menu, guys, drink whatever you want. Everyone had a great time, we partied, got to know each other like that much more, and it was celebrating a really great milestone. And I mean, we were working a ton of hours.
Him a lot of money.
We made him a ton of money, so he was very happy about that. But the easy answer would have been falling back into that audit trap of like, hey, you guys just worked a lot. That's great. Thank you so much for your effort. Why don't you go take a couple of days off? But I don't know. The happy hour was I still remember it. That's how that's how meaningful it was.
I only had one in audit as well, which is kind of wild. It's like, do they just purposely make it to where everybody has one good party and they're like, hey, enjoy the next 5 years without that.
Really interesting.
Maybe
a little more like relentless positivity is what sales has. It's what you guys have on production. It's just like whenever anyone raps on their session, you guys are clapping and applauding them. You have the full rap party then as well. There's just like so much more positivity in other functions than what we see in accounting.
So the next part here is kind of where audit trails originated, and that's where I wanted to just kind of go through with you guys any experiences that you had amongst your audit trails or accounting trails. And I created this concept of like, you know, audits take you to a whole bunch of different places, a whole bunch of different clients, and also a lot of crazy and ridiculous experiences. So this is sort of, you know, Mike, from your time at CSOD, I was at LIU when it comes to private, you were at Skullcandy and Kodiak, and then obviously worked in public, and there's some kind of crazy stories that happen. So we have actually a whole segment on Flow Academy for audit trails of just individuals and how their careers have gotten them to where they are now. But I kind of wanted to get the little, what stories do you have, if there are any that come to mind of those interesting. I'll start off with the one that you kind of brought up earlier about the eating hours. Mm-hmm. And we had one girl who, she really was trying to be a go-getter and make a name for yourself, right? There's this motivation. I want to try to prove my worth and my value. So she did one audit where she ate so many hours that first year that the next year when it came around, it was just impossible to meet the expectations. And when she rolled off of it, everybody was left holding the bag to be like, how are we going to get this done? That's not a possible thing. And she'd already left the company at that point, but it left this lasting damage for everybody else after that.
Holding the bag. I guess I'll go with my inspirational audit story here. I remember we did our training and they were sending us off into the real world. We just wrapped up our 2 weeks of training and given our like rah-rah speech before we went out and started auditing the world. And the head of the EYLA office, it was a really refreshing speech because it was basically like, hey, our business model is not that all of you are going to become partner.
Yeah.
Right. That's how it's, you look at how many people you are in this room, look at how many partners there are, you're not all going to be partner. However, EY is a great place for you to learn about business, learn how to build a company, and learn how to do great things. So we have a lot of people who go through audit, they become accountants, they become CFOs, even CEOs. So I would just encourage you to learn as much as you possibly can during your time at EY. And that actually, that gave me extra interest in the role because then it did change my perception away from, let me just get through the day to what can I learn about with the company. Mm-hmm. And I would argue in many regards, that mentality shift kind of set me up to be where we are today because I did look at my job a little bit differently and I was like, what can I learn about this company? And it made me, you know, strategically choose which accounts I wanted to audit, things like that, how I wanted to move around industries and who I wanted to talk to at the business. And it allowed me to at least feel like I was really selfishly getting something out of the experience by learning more. I mean, obviously you still get in the dumps, you're doing a bunch of rote work still at that time, but at least with a little bit of a different mentality, you can try to see the silver lining in everything that you're going through, and then it helps you a lot more. And I will say then when I went into industry and started working at Cornerstone, like it was very helpful. And that was really, you know, then you're in the weeds of one company. You can really see how things operate. So that little mentality shift at least helps you get, I think, the most out of that job. If you're not going to become partner, which vast majority of people aren't going to become partner, at least try to like extract as much selfish value out of the opportunity as you can. And that's being able to learn stuff. And that's the double-edged sword of working so much. Yeah, you work a lot of hours, but you also learn a lot more by working more hours if you're working on the right stuff. So that's kind of the, you know, you can complain about working a lot of hours, but in my time at Cornerstone, that's the most I've ever worked in my life. That time period at Cornerstone, well, sorry, short of Flo, but the amount I learned in 3 years at Cornerstone was absurd because I didn't work 2,000 hours a year for 6,000 hours total. I worked way more than that. I probably got 10,000 hours of experience in 3 years of work at Cornerstone and got to do different projects. And so with that, you know, I got probably 10 years of knowledge from versus what your average person would need to take to like accumulate that. So,
which is huge in order to even go and start something like Flowcast.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, we would not be here.
I hope the audit partner's sitting there in their armchair just been like, I trained him well.
This wasn't even the guy I worked for. It was just the head of the LA office giving us the rah-rah speech. It was not the like direct partner I worked for.
I mean, at least they're honest about it, you know?
That's what was so refreshing. A lot of partners won't
give you that honesty. You know, they don't want to like be real with you and let you make your own decision. And so I do think that's great. I have an unreal amount of stories from audit. I could literally go on for days. I think to take a comedic turn with it, my favorite one, and names will not be named. And it was not my office. It was not my KPMG office. It was a different one. But someone had the nickname Cold Cuts because they used to just bring in like deli meat and not even refrigerate it. They just left it on the counter, and that was like their lunch every day. And that's, you know, that's like maybe my favorite story from public accounting
that
I can share, I should say. But, you know, I think to your point, Mike, something that I've always thought about is if someone's like asking for career advice, which I only give to people if they like actually want it, because there's nothing worse than like getting it unwarranted. But you can't grow without friction, in my opinion. It's incredibly hard to grow without some kind of frictional force that lets you know that like there's an issue here, you need to improve here. So whether that is, I mean, it'd be the same thing at the gym. Like the reason you lift weights is like time under tension and friction. And that's what makes you grow. And it's the same thing in your personal development, in your career development, is you need to struggle, you need to try hard, or you're probably not gonna learn. And so why it is a gauntlet, and I don't think it should be what it is, to an extent, if the job isn't difficult and people don't have to struggle to learn, they will not grow professionally or personally. So I do think there is something to be said for like the time we spend. It is not wasted. As far as like audit trail and like getting to where you are in life, like Mike, you probably agree with this. Like I feel like it's like when you go on a hike and you get to the view and you're like, you know, like, and when you started the trailhead, you're like, I had no idea this was at the end of this. I clearly did not look at the map, or I took like a wrong turn at the fork, because you get to this epic view that, you know, it's like kind of serendipity and luck brought you there, but you'd have no idea you would end up there based off where you started, because you're just so busy slogging through the hike. You know, mm-hmm. just like one foot in front of the other, get over that boulder, you know, got to get up that hill, got to round that bend, whatever it is. And that's kind of how I feel like the accounting profession is like, it's hard to see from the ground POV what it's going to look like at the end, because the whole purpose of this, the whole reason people took this journey, is to get to something you can't see from there. And so you have to have a little bit of trust in the process to kind of get there. And you're going to take some weird turns. Like, I never thought that I'd work at, like, I never thought I'd work at KPMG for the amount of time I did, and then end up being the controller at Skullcandy, you know, like the U.S. controller at Skullcandy. I was very fortunate and blessed for that to happen, but it was, an incredible journey. And Skullcandy was an incredibly fun company. Like, I cannot describe how fun it was to work at Skullcandy.
Love the headphones.
Yeah, they're fantastic headphones, and they really had a great culture. Like, I'm not kidding. People used to skateboard around the office, typing on the lap. Like, I do not have the coordination for that. We would go skiing at lunch, and listen, we'd have to put hours after work into doing all that kind of stuff. But that was like incredibly fun to work there, but it was also incredibly challenging to work there. That is not an easy industry to be in. They had just recently become delisted and purchased back by private equity. And a lot of people know how hard that journey is in trying to like essentially change the valuation in the direction of a company is no easy feat. But you learn a lot in that as well. So I was very lucky to kind of like have that transition. And then the same thing is like switching that lens. I remember when I got the opportunity to go to go to Kodiak Cakes from Skullcandy, I went in and I talked to the CFO, and they didn't offer me a counter. And I was like pretty hurt by that, because I thought I did really good work at Skullcandy. And the CFO was like, hey, like let's meet. And I was like, you know, you're just going to tell me I suck. Get out of here. Like, you know, how's this going to go? And he's like, you know, the reason we didn't offer is like, he's like, in my opinion, you need to take this opportunity, because you've worked under a sharp pencil of you're trying to, you know, carefully manage costs of a company that has gone through, you know, most of its growth and is trying to change where it is directionally. And that's a very unique position to be in as an accountant in a company. It's a very difficult position to be in at a company. He's like, but now you need to feel what it's like to go through high growth, which is what Kodiak Cakes was. They were going through immense growth. And that's a completely different feel as an accountant. You have a completely different set of tolerances, things you're working on, things you're worried about. You know, it's like at Skullcandy, I was really worried about managing costs and seeing what was going on and making sure people weren't spending what they weren't going to, you know, inventory wasn't going to go stale, something like that. And then at Kodiak Cakes, it was like, I was worried about how can we get more inventory in? How do we make how do we get to the customer quick enough to actually like meet the sales demand that they have? And that's just a completely different place. So it's kind of wild. Like, you kind of need to go through those experiences, I think, to really round yourself out as an accountant and really like see, like, to get a better, you know, perspective of what the industry is. And so if someone's out there listening to this, like, I would recommend, you know, why you don't necessarily want to work for a company that is not doing well financially. I'm not saying that, but it's good to work in different economic circumstances at companies. So if you're only been in one, challenge yourself at another, at a different stage company, a different lifestyle company, something like that, because it really will shape how you view the industry pretty significantly.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm gonna try to do some like parallels and analogies here. That all really resonated with me. So very tactically, I think one of the most dangerous things you can do in audit is really adhere to same as last year policy.
Oh, like 100%.
I remember my first week of the first job, it was like, just do same as last year, Sally, whatever. And I took that instruction literally. I took last year's document, I rolled it forward, updated the date, took the tick marks, put them in the same place, and did all this stuff. And I was like, hey, I'm done with my work. And then the boss reviews it. They're like, and I remember it was a fixed asset schedule. They're like, well, what's this transaction? Why is this lease for this plane on this schedule? Is that capitalized, all this stuff? And I'm like, what are you talking about? I just like move the tick marks and stuff. So there's no thinking
yep,
about right. the work I was doing. And if you're just going through the motions and the steps, number one, you're going to have no affinity for the work you're doing. You're not going to care because you don't know what's going on. And second, you're not going to learn enough. And so I would recommend just avoiding falling in the trap of Sally. When you're starting to do a project, yes, you should look at how it was done last year, but like you got to understand why they were doing what they were doing to put that together.
Yep.
And I actually think the best learning I had on that was when we picked up a new audit client and he had to do it for the first time. There's no Sally documentation to rely on, and so you just have to figure it out. That's how you like actually learn auditing and really is doing it for the first time, in my opinion. So my big piece of advice would be just if someone says just do it the same as last year, that is not true. Like take a step back, take some time to understand the account that you're working on, the process, what this workbook means or what the schedule, whatever this means, and then like apply your critical thinking in your brain to this workbook and don't necessarily do it the same as last year. I think that gives you better context around everything. And then I'm gonna now correlate that to your hiking analogy. It's like when I drive, for example, I hate the mode where it's just the like Waze where it just tells you what the next turn is going to be and you don't have the big picture. Like I like driving with the big map and knowing where the end is going to go and what the routes are to get there and what that's all going to look like. And I think Sally forces you in that mode of just what's the next turn I'm going to take and you don't understand the big picture. Taking a step back and like understanding the workbook or whatever work you're doing and applying critical thinking gives you like the bigger picture, more excited about what's at the end of the road and then a better opportunity to learn like along the way.
I think 100%. Rolling with that hiking analogy as well is finding the joy in the journey as opposed to just expecting to get to the top of the mountain and get to see everything. And I think that's where we get burnt out. If you don't like going to the gym, then working out with that grind will be suffering intense versus if you're enjoying the process, enjoying the act of being healthy, of getting stronger, of going for the hike, of taking in the views and the scene along the way, you'll enjoy that experience a lot more. And I think that's where accounts get very cogged down of like, I just have to take the next step. This is just what I have to do to climb the mountain, as opposed to like, no, climbing the mountain is actually an experience. Some people do that for fun. Not just to go to the top of the mountain. They just hike and like, I don't even have to go to the top. I'll just kind of go around it. It's like, what do you mean? You're not trying to go to like the top? That's not the goal. It's like, no, I'm just enjoying the process and enjoying the journey. And that's where I think stress is often miscategorized. There's bad stress and there's good stress. And there's stress that leads to burnout and there's stress that just feels very fulfilling. In if you're hating what you're doing every single day and you're doing it for 16 to 18 hours a day, then that will burn you out. But when you're doing something that you enjoy the process of doing, I don't mind staying late, working on something and learning about something that I'm excited about. And it's, I think, reinstilling that excitement into work and into accounting and into auditing and all the ancillary fields that will help people feel inspired to keep going on that journey. And I think honestly, simplifying it, making it not as complex, will enable people to think about it in a more proactive way and actually learn from the stuff that they're doing instead of just rolling forward and just copying and pasting a tedious task.
Yeah, because accountants are smart. You got that job for good reason. You're smart, you worked hard, you figured stuff out, and then to be plopped down in the seat and just say, do what they did last year is not very motivating and not a good way to learn. And so I think, if you care about the work, take a step back, figure it out. Maybe that's a way to drive a little more meaning in your job.
And I do like the notion of following this journey because we all have been fortunate to have those public into private into startup journeys, which I think is really cool. And I think you gain a lot of experience of that because what you learn in public gives you that base and you see a wide array of clients and how so many different people do things, so many different management personalities. When I went to into private industry, I was at LIU. That was a very strict budget that we had to adhere to. So it was a totally different world where I'm lean. I'm like, we don't have money for lights, you know? So negotiating contracts wasn't a negotiation. It was like, this is how much we can pay. We can't go higher. There was no, as budget director, I wasn't going to departments and being like, so what do you think you guys need to spend this year? I was like, nope, I was instructed. This is how much you have. I'll work with you to figure out a way to make it work. But there's no like making your case and me evaluating whether there's a cost benefit to then getting to go into a startup realm where you are through that growth phase and you get to see how something is being built that is growing as opposed to higher education, which is kind of capped and is questionable of the value of it. So it is cool to see that journey.
You guys are making me realize I have zero experience in a cost conscious environment. So hopefully,
hopefully
we keep ripping as an organization.
Let's keep ripping.
Let me tell you something.
I'm not. Nope.
It is a different kind of pain.
So this is one of the interesting articles from the Journal of Accountancy. And I just thought this is pretty fascinating. It's Working 9 to 9, One Expert's Experience with Severe Burnout. It's from Hamza Khan.
Khan.
Nine to nine, that's soft.
Yeah.
this is the soft version. He's an author and an entrepreneur, and he delivered a TED Talk in 2015 after burning out and wrote a book in 2017 called The Burnout Gamble, just talking about how he's disheartened by the fact that 10 years after having his burnout experience, he's still a thought leader talking about burnout in the industry that hasn't changed. They estimate, and this is kind of crazy, $7.8 trillion is the annual cost to the global economy for lost productivity, disengagement, and healthcare. I don't know how they come up exactly with the numbers.
Actuaries can come up with any number.
Yeah.
But that's just like a fascinating thing, is because there is the dangers of burnout where you become less productive.
It goes back to that, the example of sales that Mike was telling us about, right? Where it's like you have to, positive momentum in positivity will breed better results. And obviously the opposite is apparently true as well, where if it's negative, you're going to have poor results. And you can see it on teams. Like, you can see it on audit teams that are beat up, you know, ground out. They do not perform nearly as well as ones that are working in cadence, are confident in what they're doing, are in alignment with everything. Like, those teams can just crush an audit, and you sit there and you're on the other audit where it's just like you're super burnt out, nothing's going well. Yeah, it just keeps going that way. You know, you don't get a break. And, you said at the end, you're like, well, why am I on this like cruddy job and this person's on this like posh job over here? And it's like, well, a lot of it has to do with just attitude around this. And, you know, we're getting beat up, so we have a bad attitude. And they were able to like build a positive one after going through a couple rough audits. And now they're in a strong working cadence. So I think, you know, I always noticed there's certain audit partners that knew how to shift that narrative on an engagement where they might go in and it was really, Overstock is a classic example. I don't know if anybody knows the history of Overstock, but like they were essentially dropped or fired almost all the big four. And then they went to KPMG, and KPMG was like, essentially like, either you do what we tell you you need to do to get through this, you know, not breaking any kind of independence things, but being like, you need to essentially do a good job of and give us audible evidence or we're out, like we'll leave. That was a really tough engagement for the first 2 years, even for KPMG, but then it became a really good working engagement for KPMG and for Overstock. Mm-hmm. And so it's wild what, like, knowing, like, hey, we can change this, we can make it a good thing, but it takes a conscious effort to get there. And the same thing's gonna be true on, you know, an industry side, you know, accounting department. It's like, if you're just getting beat up by things, if you don't try and change that narrative, like, you will be talking about it for 10 years. You know, nothing will change.
Yeah.
That's really interesting, because it's not that it can't change. It's just that people haven't allowed it to change.
Yeah, people are just leaving, like, essentially, like, the homeostasis is a negative,
right,
like, environment, and no one's trying to change what stasis is, right? No one's changing the status quo, so of course it just stays the same. You know, it's like, it's the whole idea that's like, if you don't try and change anything, it's like the whole thing. It's like, you know, you're crazy for thinking it was ever going to change without doing anything. Like, that's like the whole point of it. And so it doesn't surprise me that he's talking about it for 10 years. We might still be talking about it for 10 years. Hopefully what we're doing here changes that more rapidly than it would otherwise, because we're trying to change that homeostasis. But like, it is tough to change people's mindsets.
Mm-hmm. But this is a good example where I don't know if, as you've been talking, it got me thinking about some of my different audit jobs. And for the most part, I worked for the same senior manager. And then there were a couple times where I got plucked and joined like other engagements in other industries for maybe a quarter end or something like that. But the manager that I consistently had, we were generally working on smaller teams, more interesting engagements, but working a ton of hours. Like, mm-hmm. the reason I kind of scoff at 9 to 9, her working schedule was 6 a.m. to 11 p.m. Like,
wow.
At her desk at 6 a.m. And, you know, she didn't expect us to work those hours, but 9 to 9 was a very common thing. 9 mm-hmm. to 11 was a pretty common thing during busy season. But I got put on other jobs where it was a bigger team, but you would step in the room and there was just, like, no energy. It was really low. No one talked to each other. There was no camaraderie. And we might be leaving at 7 or 8, but it was, you know, 9 to 7 at that job felt way longer than 9 to 11 in my other jobs. It was, I don't know why, but it was just like, I enjoyed the people. Actually, I guess I do know why. I enjoyed the people I was with a whole lot more. I thought it was more interesting work. was more focused on it. And my boss, Mika Velhe, shout out. She was an incredible leader, led by example, and just did all the things the right way. So I think a lot of it goes on the senior manager and the partner of those jobs and kind of the culture that they're creating. And every client has a different culture on the audit team, sure. Right? It's an interesting dynamic.
Yep.
Yeah, one of the stats here is that 70% of the onus is on leaders to address upstream factors at the systemic organizational level. And like you said, if there's one example of an audit that is successful and the team is happy, then there's no reason that can't go across the board. It's obviously not just an isolated incident. It's just, are you not replicating that environment and creating that culture?
Yeah.
And they said a lot of it is due to lack of fairness, inconsistent values, insufficient compensation, unsustainable workload and expectations. That's just why I always say it comes down to communication. I mean, if you're on a good team where the communication is expressed and everybody's on the same page, it's easier to work together and collaborate better.
Well, and I think, you know, the audit partner, you know, if we're talking about audit, you know, partners need to be comfortable letting go a bad client. Right.
Yep.
Essentially, you know, in the case of Overstock, and I don't know all the whole history, so, you know, no one listening should quote me on all of this. But, you know, I think if we look at it externally, we can kind of say, like, they got to a point where they realized they had to take this seriously. You know, they couldn't do it the way they wanted to do it. They had to do it the way the profession demanded it. And when they're, you know, and so essentially, you know, it wasn't just KPMG. It was like all the firms that went through the process were essentially educating them. They're like, no, like, this is what you need to change. And they changed as a company. And it was great for everybody. But it is kind of wild that, you know, it's like sometimes it really just depends on the job. I remember, like, I think my worst kind of like set of hours was we were working super late and we were in the fourth basement of a government building. So like I didn't see sunlight. It was like I was very far removed from sunlight. I was pretty much a vampire. And let me tell you,
70 feet from sunlight. Yeah,
that like that 8 a.m. to like 1 a.m. was for like 3 weeks was rough.
That's brutal.
Like I'm surprised like we weren't like injected with vitamin D just to like get through the day. Like someone just like gives you a shot and says, get in the basement, you know?
But yeah, I do think if you have like the positive team and the environment and the technology in place and you're just enjoying chugging along, like it's more, you're able to be like, all right, this is miserable, sure, but there's also this optimism about it as opposed to like, this is just life and after this, I'm going to go do it again. Because this, what's interesting from Khan's study, what he was talking about, he worked for one of Canada's top ranked employees. So it wasn't like, you know, this is just a bad employer situation. They had ample benefits. They was like, you can get massages every single week if you wanted. They're saying all the right things. This is the place where you bring your whole self to work. We love to hear that. Where our employers, our bosses prioritize psychological safety and all the things that just seem like commonplace now. So it was very innovative at the time. But a lot of it, I think, comes from within the individual. And accountants are more likely to do this to themselves by accident. And I feel like I fell into this trap as well. And he says, I fell into the trap of being a type A personality, working evenings, weekends, pushing the pedal to the metal, burning the candle at both ends. I actually have that tattooed on me because of how much that resonates with me.
Wow.
I really gave into this workplace martyr complex where I neglected my health, my well-being for 11th month straight, and I would practice 9-9-7. Just 12 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Wow.
And I just think that there is a difference between doing that in a miserable environment and hating what you're doing and doing that when you're passionate about it. I imagine you have to do that building Flowcast, especially early on. It's probably not that different, but you're doing something that you're connected to. You feel you're not just a cog in a wheel. You're leading an entity. You're growing a business. And it's so much more inspiring. And how do you interject that inspiration into what you're doing in the accounting profession?
And part of it is it's a lot of fun figuring stuff out. Like that's why I want to go back to my original point around don't do Sally. Like figure out the work you're doing and just figure stuff out. There's a lot more meaning. You learn, you struggle and stuff. And it's that's how you grow as a person and get more out of it. Can I just tell a quick kind of funny story that's related to this? This morning, my daughter was not wanting to go to school because we had spring break for the last 2 weeks. So she was not wanting to go back. And she's like, when is it the weekend? I'm like, we got 4 more days until the weekend. She's like, why is the week 5 days and the weekend's only 2 days? Why can't the week be 2 days and the weekend be 5 days? And I'm like, oh, that's a deep question. Well, I'm pretty sure this goes back to the FDR days when they codified the number of days in a work week. But even a kid who has a good time when she goes to school gets it and is questioning the number of days in the work week.
Well, that's interesting.
She started asking me how many days other countries go to school. I'm like, you're in kindergarten. Oh, shut up.
You should have shipped her off to like Japan or something. Be like, I'll show you school. I was 6 days a week.
Yeah. I was like, well, in China, it's 6 days a week, and they don't have that thing called spring break or summer. So if you want it.
Yeah.
It is interesting. Yep. So the business philosophy side of here, what are the solutions we've thoughts on ways that we can address burnout? Where does that start from? Who needs to take action? What can we do? What are the responsibilities of the owner? Who can actually move the needle in this? Obviously, you can talk about it. You can try to put out thought leadership, create content to push people. Where does the needle get moved from? Is it organizations? Is it the AICPA step? Is it a government thing? Is it just a grassroots movement?
I think it's systematic, right? Like you can't just pull one lever and hope for the best thing. But I do think there are better levers to pull than others, right? Or ones that will yield results sooner and more impactfully than others. So, me personally, and I know they've recently changed the way the CPA exam's going again, and I think there's now some kind of relationship with the University of Tulane to, help people get more like CPE eligible hours or CPA like eligibility hours and stuff like that. But I think it's, people need to, I think if you want to drive people towards the industry, you need to show them that it is a viable profession and that it yields like good economic lifestyle. And that means that people are going to have to live better lifestyles. They can't be looking at their older brother, their aunt, their mother, their grandfather, whoever it is that is maybe their example of accounting, and see them working miserable hours being a miserable individual. And they need to see that they're like being paid fairly economically. Cause I do think you've brought this up multiple times, Mike. It's like, well, if you want to solve the problem, you can throw money at it and you will eventually have to if you wait too long. It's like I always look at problems as like time is a cost lever, and the longer you wait to solve it, the more expensive that problem becomes, regardless of what problem it is. But I also think like having graduates not walking into the profession and having to learn exceptionally more content is pretty huge. And universities need to take responsibility for their lack of quality education there, period. They can't go in and just say like, well, everybody that goes into audit's like miserable for the first year. Well, part of that misery is they don't know what they're doing at all. Mm-hmm. And audit is nuanced, so is tax, so is advisory. But you can have paths within the university to help prepare people for the job that they want to have. They just don't, right? Because they probably don't see it as driving it being, worth the investment. But it's like, well, once your accounting department disappears because no one's going into it, maybe it was. So I think that's part of it. And then I think the barrier of the CPA looks like the CPA exam needs to be more practical to what people are actually doing and potentially the path that they're taking. But even if you're going to have it broad, make it like actually applicable to what they're doing. How much of the exam do you remember actually doing in any part of your career? Right? It's incredibly like you probably don't even remember because it's not something you're probably tested on. And I know, CPA, the NASB and everybody will be upset about that, but it's like it's the truth. And if you don't think it's the truth, then you're not doing the work. You're so disengaged from the work that's being done on the ground, you have no idea how far off your exam is. Or even the education requirements. It's like, well, it needs to be like a business computing degree. It can't just be a computing degree. Oh, I didn't know there was a huge difference. Why? Because there's not. Oh, you took an ethics class. You didn't take a business ethics class. Well, you can't get an exam. Or, hey, you didn't work. They get really upset if you didn't have your hours underneath a CPA or something. It disqualifies the work. And it's like, it's just a bit ridiculous, and they use it as a barrier to entry to protect the designation rather than actually prepare people for the career they're going to have or make them a better CPA advisor to the people that they're going to work with. And so it's a bit useless. But I think if you look at it, and that's one end of it, but it's really hard to pull that lever, and it's really hard to change that dynamic. What is more likely to happen is changing the way the industry does the work today as an example to lead people. Because you have to fix a lot of things to fix the educational component and make it an easier barrier to entry. But if we change the way we do the work today, we can set a better example that people are going to then want to enter into the industry. And so I think it's more on us that are currently working in it, myself excluded, because now I'm just a subject matter expert. But to really take that to heart. And to me, when I look at the organization, it can be, you can change process, but it's relatively hard to find a significantly more efficient process. You can change the culture, but culture is kind of sticky and it can be really hard to change, especially as one individual, especially if you don't have buy-in from your other leaders within the organization, which in my perspective, you're generally not going to, because most accounting departments are misused. We know that because they don't have strategic alignment in what they do. And we've seen that in studies. And so when you look at all that, it's like, you know, you're kind of left with technology as like a lever to pull. And I know this might seem a bit self-serving because we're a tech company, but I do truly believe that like technology is a unique overlay to the different competencies of the work you do, whether that is, you know, recording or managing or reporting. It kind of layers on top of all those. So by pulling that lever, you can actually change the processes in each one of those areas, depending on the technology that you're using. And you can drastically change the way you do your work immediately. And it's kind of like to the point where it just gives you breathing room to change the other things. Because I think a lot of people find change hard because they're already treading water, right? So it's like they're already sitting there, barely have their nose out of the water. Their lips are already submerged and they're holding a 50-pound weight or whatever. Like, you know, you could give me a pebble and I'd be struggling. And they're trying to, and it's like, all it is like, you're just removing the weight out of their hands. That doesn't change the fact that they're still in water, but it changes how much they're carrying, and it lets them reassess and redo everything. And it can be a real saving grace. So it's a unique lever, I think, to pull to really change it. And we do truly see this in the evidence. Like, we do have like independent data from the University of Georgia that helped us do the study that shows that people that actually have like a synergistic relationship with technology, and what we mean by that is like the technology works intuitively in a way they want to, it is truly a helper to them. Their work persona suggests that they have enough time to get their work done, or they'll have enough time to get their work done. They have a bigger share of voice in the company. They find more competency in the way they do their work. They feel like they're paid more fairly, even though probably they're not getting paid too much differently. They're probably just not working as much. Their whole persona changes because they were given that breathing room and they have a completely different dynamic. And then those individuals are probably using that time, if I had to guess, to fix other things like process, like culture, like everything else, because they're not just struggling, in every aspect of their life. And so I think that's a huge thing for us to remember, is that people do that. And I don't want to eat up your guys' time to say something, but what we notice is that what really correlates strongly with synergy and your relationship with technology is the level of integration that technology has to your business environment. And I think a lot of people do not understand integration. When they think integration, they think at it from a transactional point of view, moving data from one point to another, from one software to another, into the system, into reporting, whatever it is. But that is a very myopic view of what integration is. Integration really means is, am I integrating with the entire work persona? That means their storage. Am I integrating with the way they like to communicate? That's not just email, that's in Slack. And that's not just integrating the way it talks to you. Integrating the way you talk to the platform. Does it integrate with your productivity tools like Microsoft Excel or, Google Sheets or whatever you're using? All of that is integration. And all of that is that is what we talk about when we talk about high levels of integration. It's really broad within the organization, not just data. That's not moving data. That's moving decision points and information, and that's working wherever you work. And that is what we actually see drives a synergistic relationship with that technology and really starts to change things. And I think we just have such a classic or old view of how we do these things that we have a hard time removing ourselves from it. And this is something that I've been like trying to harp in internally, but it's a really hard concept to really like manage and think about, because we don't teach it. We don't really learn it anywhere. So the only way you do it is by like essentially running into enough walls that you're eventually like, okay, I think there's a wall here, and I'm now going to take a step to the side and move forward. It's like going through a maze. So I think, me personally, that's how we change the dynamic going forward, is we do it within the industry, and we look at the levers we can pull today, and the quickest lever is that technology lever.
That's like having to bring in groceries and you keep on struggling every time you're trying to bring the groceries. And, wouldn't it be good if we automated this door? Like, when it sees me present, it would open up. But it takes up until the point where it becomes so drastically problematic to you to actually make those changes happen. And to your point on the stats there, yeah, 38% of accounting professionals indicated having low levels of burnout when they did have that synergistic relationship. And that's why I think it's so difficult to get people on board to go get you. We've all gotten the phone calls of, oh, can you implement, you guys would do great if you implement this software. You're like, the last thing I need is now something else that I need to implement and then integrate into what I'm doing.
Yep.
And it's because you want to ensure you do have that synergistic relationship, because the last thing is like, oh, this is this other system. And I get that all the time. If it's like, hey, I know you have, you're keeping that in the Google Sheet, and I know it's in Asana, but could you also throw it into Airtable? That way, you know, it can get submitted to this thing. And I'm like, geez, like, why do we, I got three, put this into three yep. different systems in order to, because every team's using their own thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why I think having accounting at the center of those conversations would be important and critical, 100%. Because it's like, oh, well, don't worry, they'll adapt to our system. It's like, oh, maybe we should adapt to the accountant system.
Yeah.
My crazy idea around this, and it kind of hits on what you were saying earlier, is, I mean, when you leave college, should you go into industry first, learn how to actually do accounting before you audit
accounting? You'd be a lot better auditor.
You'd be much better. I remember after 6 months at Cornerstone actually closing the books and putting a reconciliation together, I thought, wow, I would be such a better auditor had I done this first and then gone in and audited the work afterwards. It's like asking someone to like referee a basketball game when yeah. they've never seen a game before, and you just yeah. handed them like a rule book with no pictures or anything, and then they're expected to go call an NBA game accurately. Like that's not how it's going to work. It'd be interesting.
I would pay to watch that.
It'd be a lot of yelling, I'm sure. But like, yeah, you know, doing the work, then you would move into audit, and you're not going to be as inefficient, mm-hmm. right? Because when you send people into a job and they don't know what they're doing, everyone has to train them. It's an all hands on deck thing. Not only are you inefficient as the person doing that job, your boss is inefficient because they have to teach you how to do this. So I almost wonder, like,
even the client, because the client's often training the intern or the first year associate. Like, I remember when a client had to tell me what a reversing journal entry was, and I was like, wait, what? You're allowed to do this?
I had the exact same thing. Her name was Christine at Lionsgate. Let me explain a reversing journal entry. It's just a thing we set up. I'm like, oh, okay, interesting.
I'm an expert.
But that's where, like, you know, I never would have had that conversation. I never would have had to ask my boss, had I done accounting before mm-hmm. I started that? And then are you maybe in a position where as an audit firm now, you know, one person who has 2 years of experience can do the work of like three staff auditors who don't know what they're doing, and maybe I can pay twice as much for that person to get the work done because they know what the hell they're doing, and everyone is more efficient at that point. But it requires paying more to get people to go back into audit to do yep. that, and it's a complete mentality shift.
Yeah.
And by the way, this will never work because all universities are incentivized to send all of their students to audit firms because that's how they get the highest placement rate,
yep.
which is how they then recruit the next class of students yep. to pay the tuition to keep the university going. So it will never change. But to me, that feels like going to industry first and then getting paid more to go be an right. auditor and have that be like a bit more of a prestigious role because of the compensation is like one of the fixes here.
Yeah. And I think the fact that audit is viewed, it's completely devalued as a concept. So it's just like, oh, well, we just need someone to do this tedious stuff. It's not skilled work, so it could be entry level. It's like, why are you making people go to school for this very technical, specific degree to then have them do something so tedious and monotonous that there's no skill actually involved?
Yeah.
And that's why I think there is the potential perhaps with AI that eventually you are able to have people who, I would love to see a requirement where actually in order to get a job in audit, you actually need to have 2 years of experience. Like that would be on the job requirement list.
Yeah, I agree.
And they do pay you more, and you have to kind of, you manage the AI bots essentially that do some of that tedious stuff.
And to be honest, like it's so much easier to get placement out of audit if you have experience as like a staff at a company, right? Like if you were even a bookkeeper for a short period of time, because no one wants to hire an auditor that doesn't know how to actually do a journal entry. It's like, well, I can write one out. I've never put one in the system, right? Like I remember my first day at Skull Candy, they're like, well, yeah, and you're gonna put the journal entry. And I was like, yeah, so like I can totally like get the right numbers in the right accounts in Excel and hand them to you because I've done that multiple times. But can you actually show me how I do that in SAP or like NetSuite or whatever we're using? It's like, you know, like another, you know, and that's what it's like. No one wants to hire someone in to be their, you know, director of accounting, their controller, even assistant controller. They're like, great, they have a ton of technical knowledge, but they don't know how to actually submit an invoice. They don't know how to like, you know, approve a bill. They don't know how to do a journal entry in the system. Well, it's like, I don't want to hire this person for a lot of money and they can't do the job out of the gate. So it does fix a lot of problems for people.
Yeah. Yeah.
But speaking about the experiences that you can use as we kind of near towards the end of our session here, this is sort of the different job opportunities I think that exist in the accounting profession and in the ancillary professions that people don't typically realize or that they don't think about. I think when you have these things in mind and you have a goal in mind beyond just like, I just want to make partner and call it a career, that can give you a little bit of more inspiration as well. And one example I want to bring up is I had an individual who was an intern of mine back when I was the budget director at Long Island University. And he had reached out. He said, hey, I see you're doing something in the creative space. And I know you have the accounting background. I just kind of want to understand like how your career kind of got to that point. Because he's like, I'm very interested in music and I play in a band. And I kind of pointed to, there's a guy I work out with and he works for Live Nation. And he's in like the financial analysis. He does venue analysis basically of deciding what would be the best ticket price and how many mm-hmm. seats should we buy, how many days should we buy it for, how for this band that's going to go on tour. And he also gets a tour with his band. So the fact that
that's dope.
He's at a company of people who, like you said, if they're everyone's skateboarding, I think Patagonia is the company down, are they in San Diego, I think, and they would have like surf sessions as part of their workday because everybody who worked for the company was like really into surfing. I don't know if it was Patagonia or another entity.
Rip Curl? You might be thinking Rip Curl.
Maybe.
Rip Curl makes sense.
But you know what I mean? It's the company you're working for embraces the lifestyle that they're actually creating the brand of, and the people who work there can be part of that. Live Nation, Rock Nation, these are companies, they're music entities, and so people who work there are all musical minded and they all work in different aspects of the business. Similar to at Flowcast, it's all people who are accountants, but they're doing different parts of the business, but still have that same background. And I think that that's a really cool thing. So I advised him, I was like, look, you're learning. He works at one of the big four accounting firms in VAT. So he's doing, you know, international tax and stuff like that. I'm like, you should think about how you can utilize your knowledge of international. Think about like the Eras tour with Taylor Swift having to go to different venues on these different countries and other bands that do international tours. Use that to your advantage because you're going to be one of the very few people with this passion and insight into the music industry that also understands how international tax works.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And that's huge. And so there's a bunch, obviously, that you can do here at Flowcast that I think the different skills line you up for.
Yeah.
Well, I think I always go back. Like Skull Candy was a real fun place, and Kodiak Cakes was a lot of fun too. And Mike, you're fun sometimes as well. but I will say
how the quarter go.
But you know, it's you know, one thing I loved about Skull is like we'd literally ski at lunch, right? Or we would mountain bike at lunch, or you know, or if people just want to like work out, or it's like. It was like they really just lived that mountain lifestyle. And that was like really huge to like life satisfaction. You're like, well, you know, I might be working late hours, but like I did just get free refills on a powder day. And that's pretty epic. And, you know, depending on your personality and stuff. So it's like sometimes you even look for companies, like you said, like Rip Curl that just like goes surfing. It's like, it's not, you may not have a passion for Rip Curl, but you have a passion for surfing and it aligns with you culturally, you'll probably find a lot more satisfaction with that that might help you kind of pull you out of that negative cycle.
But so there are a lot of jobs, a lot of people work in public, they've been burnt out now at this point. And so obviously we'd like to be a haven for individuals who maybe have a mismatch of personality type or whatever it is that they're doing, that they still want to utilize that accounting background to go do it. So I know BDR is a big thing. So what type of person, Mike, would be a good match to get into the BDR role?
Yeah, I think for starters, we love hiring accountants at Flowcast, obviously. All of us here are accountants. We've all done things that are not things we majored in and we figured it out. So I think we can be really great at what we do. And yeah, it's about aligning like personality and thought process with the right role. So BDR stands for Business Development Rep. That's the entry-level sales job at Flowcast. As you would expect for sales, you want to be someone who's extroverted, you know, really social, good at communicating with people, happy to talk on the phone. You have no problems with that kind of thing, and really driven and motivated, and you want to get stuff done and work with a sense of urgency. I think that's what makes the best sales reps. So you come in here, and there's a big misconception around sales. There's the whole like selling ice to an Eskimo type thing, but that's not what you're here to do. When you do sales, it's actually the best sales reps ask the most questions. So you're doing a lot of discovery. You'll get a prospect on the phone, you know, Stefan, you probably started by chatting with one of our BDRs at some point. I hope they ask you some questions around your accounting operations and how your month-end close and reconciliations and audit were. They're trying to uncover any pain points you might have and then see if you have pain points that we could solve with our software. If we are talking to you and you say, yeah, I have some problems with the month-end close, or, oh, that audit sucked, that thing didn't tie out and that really hit us, then they would introduce you to the account executive, who then is the sales rep who runs the demo, understands your pain points in a little more detail, and then tries to like map out how our solution could help you with those challenges. And that's the really common promotion path for the BDR role. So you come in, you do BDR for 12, 18, 24 months, something like that. And then you get the opportunity to interview for different jobs. And the most common path is through the account executive role. You become a sales rep, make a lot of money, a lot more than you're going to make in accounting. I'll tell you that right now. One of the proudest things I have is when I see, you know, 26-year-olds around here making more money than the partners that they were working for 2 years ago. That's like a very cool dynamic to see around here. So I would say AE, account executive, is kind of like the most common and coveted position within Flowcast. But if you're not the type of person who likes closing business and you don't love the stress of commissions, because it is a really, it's a different type of stress. It's the stress of, am I going to get paid this quarter or not? Am I going to close enough deals? So there's different stress that comes with it. But if you don't want that, you know, maybe you're more of a relationship-focused person. Then you can move into an accounting success manager role at Flowcast, where you work with our customers to understand what their processes are like, make sure they're happy with Flowcast. If they need any tweaks made to the application, they can work with you on that, and you're just there to support them and make sure they're successful. Or maybe you love the product and you want to learn more about that area, you can move into the product team and start working on that. We also have our accounting technology consultant group, which is one where if you enjoy certain aspects of audit, and namely the aspects that I enjoyed were getting to see different companies, getting to learn about their processes and kind of extract as much knowledge as I could from that job, ATC is really good for that one, because you are introduced to the client when we sign them. You then work with them to get them implemented on Flowcast. But a Flowcast implementation isn't just like configure this and set this up. It's like, okay, tell me about your close. Okay, here's how you have documented. Let's work through that. Let's make sure everything's good. We're feeling good about the processes. All right, that's how we want to do it. Let's get Flowcast set up for you, and you start working in that environment. So it's more of a, we call it accounting technology consultant because it is more of a consulting type lens. And my pitch on that one is, what's really cool about that job is if you do that for like a year at Flowcast, you'll do well over 100 setups, which means that you got to know 100 different accounting departments, learn about how they operate, help them get better, set them up, and then move on to the next one and learn more from them. And so it's this like conveyor belt of knowledge and getting access to different industries. And I would argue, if you like accounting but just want a pit stop to learn a lot, the ATC role is actually really good for that, because you get exposure to all these different companies, all these different industries. Are they in cost-cutting mode? Are they in growth mode? What does that look like? And you can kind of feel it out. And then when you go to interview for your next job, your pitch is, hey, I set up over 100 companies. I helped them optimize their close process. I learned all about it. Excited to bring all that knowledge to your company. It's killer for your career path as you move up in that world. So those are some of the most common careers at Flowcast. And, you know, I love hiring accountants into this role. And the common thing about all those jobs is there's no major for those jobs. There's no major for sales. There's no major for customer success. There's no major for accounting technology consultant. And so if we're going to hire someone for that job and teach them to do it, regardless, we might as well hire accountants for that job and teach them how to do it. And that's what, like, to me, it brings a lot of the magic and the mojo to the table at Flowcast. So yeah, if you're looking to do something new, but don't want to burn all that accounting knowledge, and you want to put it to use in a meaningful way, then we're the spot for you.
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody's like been on that engagement where you have that one guy that like really enjoys like the walkthroughs. He goes chats with the clients a lot and stuff like that, and kind of likes to explore and make a meaningful conversation with them. And they always come back from those relations like that. Like, you know, you're like, hey, go ask that accounting manager X, Y, and Z, and they come back like, you know, an hour later, and you're like, what the hell were you doing? You'd be a good BDR.
Yeah,
you'd be a great BDR, and it's a cool team. I mean, I will say, like, you know, accounting really sets you up to be a hard worker in a lot of ways, be a problem solver, be inquisitive, and to be organized. But that's not in a complete, like, skill set for, you know, being successful long-term in business. Being a BDR really teaches you how to reach out to people that are difficult to work with, that don't want to hear from you, and bridge that gap to a want of understanding and seeing if you can actually help them or not, which is incredibly important if you want to lead an accounting or finance organization in the future. Being able to reach out to the different business leaders that do not want to talk to you in an organization, that is a skill set you can learn as a BDR that you will not learn traditionally in your role as an accountant. So there's a lot to learn from these things. I took this role in marketing because I felt like there was a missing gap for me to go be a CFO, because I didn't understand enough about the marketing part of an organization. And I said, well, there's nothing really better than to just step into it and challenge myself to look through new lens in it. And it's been incredibly insightful into marketing and into sales and different parts of an organization. And there's things I've learned in this role that no other CFO will understand about their sales or marketing organization. And that's incredibly powerful. But the same thing for like an ATC, you're essentially almost still doing the consulting role, but with like a healthy work-life balance. Yes. And being appreciated in a bigger way. And you are, to your point, Mike, you're really seeing how hundreds of organizations set up their close, and you can identify the best practices and get a feel for what problems yield what kind of processes and what kind of fixes. And that's huge, but you're not doing that in an awful way to your health, you know? So I'm a huge fan. I'm obviously slurping the juice over here. And I think if anybody's at all inquisitive of it, like, reach out to our excellent recruiting team. I know I worked with Barbara, and I don't know what she's recruiting for these days, but like, excellent to work with. I could not recommend her enough. and working with like Melissa or anybody else, so just really good to just get on a call, and they will help you understand if you're a good fit or not, you know? Yeah. So don't be afraid of reaching out.
Yeah, I would say if you have any entrepreneurial aspirations, I think the BDR group is particularly impactful. And I've noticed we've had a few people come to Flowcast and leave to go start their own companies, and they all happen to be former BDRs. It's something where it gets you out of your comfort zone. Like, you're emailing, you're cold calling. It's not natural to a lot of people, but the reality is, to start a business, that's the stuff you do. I'm a professional BDR, but just with a bigger title than that. At the end of the day, I'm always trying to, convince someone to do something that we need to move forward as a business, and constantly developing this business. And so it's the best skill set if you have entrepreneurial aspirations.
It is really cool. I think these three roles, where the BDR is that entrepreneurial spirited person who's perhaps has a little more ambition. They want to grab their career by the horns, do something different. They're more outgoing. They kind of just maybe fell into accounting and didn't necessarily always want to be an accountant for the long term. And it allows you to take a little more ownership, and you're not a cog in a wheel anymore. You're directly driving revenue, which is, I think, is a really cool aspect to that rewarding of, we talk about what causes burnout.
Well, that's you're not a cog in the wheel, like, really resonates with me. I mean, I think to the point where what's really cool about these jobs is if you're going to be great at them, you need really good business acumen and just an ability to like think on your own and make decisions. I mean, we're obviously going to guide people and give them some processes and like frameworks or whatever to work within. But at the end of the day, to be good at any of these jobs, you're doing business, and you need to have good business acumen and think on your feet and do things the right way. And it's way different than Sally.
Yeah.
There's no Sally for an ATC. There's no Sally for a BDR. It's like, you're live in a conversation. You got to figure it out and deploy like good judgment and have good business acumen to be successful at that job. And it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, it is.
And then I think after that, even with the ASM, it's that good mix of, public and in industry if possible. And you're able to take these different skills, and it is more for the relationship building part of it. Yeah. And then I think with the ATC, which is really cool, is for those accountants who maybe aren't as prone to jumping. They kind of want to still do something that's technical, a little bit more predictable. And there's a big appeal to working with a lot of high profile clients and getting to understand how all of their businesses operate. And I was one of those people who had a great time getting to go perform walkthroughs and just understand what was happening at these different clients. And you get to learn their business and understand their processes. You get to continue that career growth, where I think there's a fear that if you leave public accounting, your career growth is going to stop. And that's not the case. And I think ATC is a really good example of that, because you just keep going, and maybe even tenfold.
I think it's the best way to increase your knowledge set, honestly. Like, it's such a condensed learning time. If you're completely over accounting, you're done with it, BDR is a great path for you. If you're still like, I hate audit, I want to get better, joining a cool tech company would be awesome, learn more about accounting, like, ATC is a job for you. And then the door's open for you. You can always go back to accounting. Hell, if you want to go work in our accounting department, you can join our internal accounting department. That sounds great. But there's a host of opportunities for people, depending on how over accounting you are.
Yep. So many different things, including even sales engineers, recruiting itself, product, as you mentioned,
as a bunch of accounts,
marketing, as you talk about. You could come be on camera if you want to work with me. So all of this stuff, here's my plug to flowcast.com/careers. Anybody who's interested, definitely go check it out, because we are growing, we are hiring, and it's a great opportunity, especially as you're coming off of this busy season. If burnout's in your head, think about this as an opportunity to get behind a product and do something that works for your personality.
Yep. Amen.
So with that, we are wrapping up our session. So final words of advice for anybody who's burning out or currently kind of going through this as we near the close of busy season officially. Mental Health Month. What advice do you have for those in the industry?
I mean, I think most of the conversation we had today was long-term fixes. To me, the short-term fix is a bit of a change in mentality around positivity and celebrating what we've accomplished and getting together to celebrate it, not just saying, hey, go take some more time off and be by yourself and do this kind of thing. You should do that as well. You should give your team some time off, a couple days. But first, throw a party, have a good time, have a positive attitude about it. You all just worked hard. You worked together. You accomplished something. You were in the trenches. Like, celebrate it a little bit. Have a positive attitude.
100%. I would say if you're struggling with the burnout right now, like, realize that you're not alone. But also realize that there is a way out, because people are succeeding as accountants. They are working in a different paradigm and they're finding a lot of success in what they're liking. So don't lose hope. Just, you know, realize it is a journey and, you know, you're going to have to take some steps to get there, but it is definitely possible to do it. And not just, you know, there's 5% of people out there are successful. No, there's 25% of people out there are successful. So that doesn't mean that they're the only ones that can be. That just means that we need to shift the way we're doing things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think a key there is happy hours do work. there's something to be said about that. But I do think it is appreciating where you are along the journey right now and recognizing how can I make this the biggest learning experience that I possibly can, and understanding that there are a lot more different career routes out there that exist and ways that you can use your unique background as an accountant, having worked in public, wherever you have worked, to parlay that into your next career option. Because all of us, I think, are a testament to using that as a background and then doing something different with it. And it only becomes possible, you only get that job if you have that background and you have that experience.
Yep.
So this has been our special double, perhaps triple episode of the FinTech Flow. Thanks everybody for tuning in. It was great having a double guest here with Mike and Stefan. So yeah, tune in and we'll see y'all next time.
Good stuff, Drew. Great job. Thanks for joining, Stefan.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for letting me be involved.
Anytime. Thanks for checking out the FinTech Flow. As a reminder, this episode is available for CPE credit, and you can get that at Flowcademy or on the Earmark app. Details are in the description below.